JSA in the 90s. This episode, a spotlight on the holidays with Starman and the Flash. Hello, and welcome to JSA in the 90s, a podcast dedicated to the Justice Society of America and related characters as published in the 1990s. We are a proud member of the Firewater Podcast Network. My name's the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host, but guess what? I have brought along some friends to help me celebrate the holidays. We'll meet my second co-host a little bit later, but for now, my first co-host today is one of the biggest fans I know of James Robinson's Starman. He's gone as far as to even cosplay as Jack Knight at a convention, though I will always remember him as one of the few folks who actually looks back fondly on their time as a user of AOL. You've got mail, buddy. Folks, please help me welcome Mr. Jose Rivera. Welcome to the holidays at the JSA Brownstone, Jose. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
Thank you very much for having me. Yes, I do remember AOL very fondly. That's my childhood right there. Unfortunately.
Oh, the amount of DC Comics chat rooms I was in on AOL is just a huge volume of those things over those years.
I was wasting a lot of ink printing pictures that they had on the AOL DC Comics area.
You know what? This is going to go down a rabbit hole, but I used to save the covers. Like they would share the covers without the trade dress. So it wouldn't, instead of saying like Starman on the top, it would just be the image. I would save those to my hard drive. And I think I still have like thousands of these things from the 90s, late 90s, early 2000s. So
I remember when they had the Sovereign 7 area.
Oh, wow. That goes back a ways. Oh, man. Jeez. Well, we're not here to talk about Sovereign 7 today, people. Don't worry. We are, in fact, though, going to talk about two JSA-related stories from the 1990s that were holiday-themed. Jose and I, we're going to be discussing James Robinson's Starman, issue number 27 from 1996, a story entitled Christmas Night. That's with a K. Then, with my second co-host a little bit later, we'll be discussing Mark Waid's Flash, number 73, from 1992, with a story featuring Jay Garrick teaming up with Wally West entitled One Perfect Gift. Now, I mentioned this last year, but my goal is going to be every December on JSA in the 90s and eventually JSA in the 2000s, we're going to do a holiday-themed episode from comics that were published in that era, something related to JSA. Like, again, we're picking 90s comics for the JSA here. Okay, so I want to say something separate of all of that, that if you are a Starman fan, I strongly urge you, please check out the podcast called Starman Chronicles, hosted by our friends Chris and Cindy Franklin, right here on the Firewater Podcast Network. You can find back episodes on the Supermates podcast feed. You can find one episode in the early days of the Justice Society Presents feed. Now, the show's been on hiatus for a while, but the back episodes are wonderful and well worth seeking out. So be sure to check out the Starman Chronicles.
I can attest to that because I used to listen to it constantly and nag them about it.
I was just reading one of your comments on the website the other day from there. Now, we got a lot to talk about today. So before we get too much further, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. This episode of JSA in the 90s is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, every episode will select a collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStock Trades library. Usually, it's going to be tied into this month's discussion in some way, shape, or form. I broke that taboo this time because my pick has absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking about today, and I don't care. Well, other than Christmas, let's put it that way, because this is something that every geek should want under their Christmas tree. It is DC versus Marvel Omnibus hardcover with a George Perez cover. I mean, this is great, man. This is all the classic crossovers you want. You know, it's Superman versus Spider-Man. It's Batman versus the Hulk. It's Uncanny X-Men versus the Teen Titans. All those ones, you know, Batman's fighting Captain America or Punisher and Daredevil and Batman and Spider-Man, and just, it goes on and on and on. There is 1,096 pages in this thing. Listen to some of these creators. Denny O'Neill, George Perez, Dan Jurgens, Chris Claremont, Walt Simonson, J.M. DeMatteis, Mark Bagley, Jerry Conway, John Romita Jr., so many amazing, talented people. Again, 1,096 pages. You know you've read some of these, but maybe you haven't read them all. And you can get it right now. This hardcover normally goes for $150. It is 50% off, so it's only $75. I mean, that would look great under anyone's Christmas tree. I'm just saying. You know you want it, folks. So DC versus Marvel Omnibus hardcover, George Perez cover. I absolutely love it. Now, Jose, did you happen to bring something to chat about?
I did, and it actually relates to this issue because it is Starman Compendium Volume 1, James Robinson, Tony Harris, and various artists. I love various artists.
Oh, they're so good. So good.
If you like Starman, or if you even are remotely interested in Starman, this is 1,448 pages of this series. And you know what? It used to be $60 on in-stock trade, 40% off, $35.99. Not a bad deal.
That's incredible, man. And you're going to get like the first 42 issues of Starman, all the crossovers from that time as well. And the size of that thing, that could stop a cosmic rod blast. It's so thick.
And even better, it has the Shade miniseries. And I have a personal reason why I like that Shade miniseries and with Starman in general.
Okay, tell me more.
In 2003, I started my first semester at BMCC. I knew I wanted to write, but I didn't know what I wanted to write about. So I started thinking about influences. Ralph Bakshi's American Pop and Starman, specifically the Knight and the Mist family's feud, but the Shade and the Ludlows feud from the miniseries really got me, especially issue 4. And because of that, I came up with a 5-book series, multi-generational, and that does not happen without Starman and the Shade. I've written 2 first drafts, currently in the middle of a third, and I have 2 mapped out. And again, it all comes back to Starman and the Shade. So if you'd like to read about Starman and family feuds, please check out this compendium.
That's fantastic. What a cool story. And to give you such a big inspiration for something that gives you passion, that's just, I think that's what every writer wants, is their audience to be inspired. So that's awesome, man.
Thank you.
So folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support, because, you know, running the Firewater Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services, and a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. If you're enjoying the JSA in the 90s podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FWPodcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. And at certain tiers, you get mentioned on your show of choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized specifically on the Justice Society Presents podcast. So our thanks go out to these all-star squadron of supporters. Thank you, Alex Osias, Al the Comics Guy, Bill Beer, Bruno Diaz, Chris Mort, Craig Fletcher, David Ace Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, Ducky, Extremely Uncanny, George Van Note, Gord Tolton, Jason Keane, Jay Campbell, Keechee Baker, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Matt Ev, Michael Bailey, Michael Crouch, Mike Atchison, Mike Zumkowski, Roger Preeb, Russell Burbage, Symbol Pending, Ted Kilvington, and Tim Price. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FWPodcast. As I always say, folks, it's about building a community of JSA fans around the show, so we want you chime in the comment section, or you can find us on social media as JSA Presents. Share your thoughts on the Starman comic, share your thoughts on the Flash comic books. I mean, just want to let you guys know, we've already done a spotlight episode on Jay Garrick. I will be doing a spotlight episode specifically on Jack Knight Starman. So this is just more of a taster, really, doing the holiday special. But I want to know your thoughts on how much you love Starman, because I think most of us who live through the 90s do. In fact, let's ask you, Jose, what is your personal origin story with James Robinson Starman, and why does it mean so much to you?
I grew up with Will Payton Starman when I was a kid because he was in my Who's Who binder. He was in a lot of the Superman comics that I read. And I remember reading Eclipso, The Darkness Within #2 when he died.
Ugh.
The only thing I really knew about the Robinson and Harris series was from an issue of previews where I mistook it for a Vertigo title because it had that very mature look. But years later, when I'm in high school, I go to my local library and they start having trade paperbacks. One of them was Starman, A Wicked Inclination. I wanted to see what, if anything, it had to do with Will Payton. So I remember checking it out, reading it during lunch, and immediately falling in love with the Shade's journal page, which started it off, because I had never seen a comic open like that before. As I continued reading the trade, I fell in love with Opal City and Jack Knight, and I can tell you the exact moment I fell in love with Starman. It was during the Sand and Stars arc, where Jack is on his way to meet Wesley Dodd. He's approaching the front door, and he's nervous because he's about to meet one of his heroes.
And when the door opens, it's Dionne Belmont, wife of Sandman, and celebrated author.
For some reason, I love the fact that Jack was more excited to meet the author than the actual superhero. In his mind, Dionne was more important than Wesley, and that just told me a lot about his character. From that moment on, I was a Starman fan for life. I was buying the earlier trades to pick up with the story. I got some t-shirts from my local comic shop, and anytime DC Direct put out some merch, I would try to get my hands on it. I have the pin, I have the Starman badge, and thanks to our host, I have the watch.
Well, I'm glad you enjoy it. I wanted it to go to a good home.
Starman's always going to be special to me because it's the reason why I wanted to get serious about writing. It made me realize things like characterization, long-form storytelling, and knowing your ending before you write the first issue. For some reason, when I found out James Robinson did that, I fell in love with that concept. I've actually gotten to meet Tony Harris, was nice enough to sign my Zero issue, but he also did a quick head sketch of Jack for me, my first sketch ever. And during my first New York Comic Con in 2010, I randomly saw James Robinson walking the floor. Wasn't scheduled to be there. He was just buying comics. So I went to approach him, but I tried not to do the fanboy thing of, thank you for creating this wonderful thing, this most important. No, I said, look, very big fan. It's had a wonderful influence on me, and he couldn't have been more gracious. He even took a picture with me, and that's a memory I will carry till the day I die.
That's so cool.
You know how they say something can impact you for life, and you think, oh, they're just being dramatic or overly romantic about it? No. For me, I can say Starman absolutely had a positive impact on my life. And I'll never stop being grateful for it.
That's incredible, man. I mean, just how much it influenced you and how you came at it later and you weren't even there on the ground floor. Actually, with the timing of you reading the trades, was the story done at that point? Or did you start picking up the trades while it was still on the shelves?
I think by that point, they were still in Stars My Desk. I think the 50th issue might have come out around the time I was picking up the trades.
Okay. Well, I'm so glad that you got a chance to tell James Robinson how much it meant to you and Tony Harris. That's incredible, man. And I knew that I wanted to have you on the show when I decided to talk about the Starman issue. So for me, I knew Ted Knight was Starman from like the JLA, JSA crossovers, things like that, All-Star Squadron, the other JSA appearances. So I knew Ted Knight. And kind of like you said, you're a Will Payton guy. I was a Will Payton guy. Specifically, the Starman comic, the Will Payton one, had a very special place in my heart because it brought me back to mainstream superhero comics, because at that point I was just reading like the, you know, the dark stuff. I was going through that's what I call my phase, where I was only reading mature comics. I would read, you know, whether it be Vertigo or Proto, I guess it was pre-Vertigo at that point, but either way, I wasn't really reading mainstream comics. Specifically, what brought me back though was Starman number 26, the Will Payton story, because David Knight makes his first appearance there and tries to reclaim the name of Starman from Will Payton. So I actually came back because of the JSA connection, and that brought me back to a whole bunch of mainstream superhero comics. So I love that. I love that connection. Then 2 years before the first issue of the Jack Knight Starman series came out, I was at that time a massive fan of the Ultraverse. And one of the comics in the Ultraverse was called Firearm. It was written by James Robinson. And if you read it, it's kind of a prototype, really, for Robinson's Starman. Like the way the lead character talks in caption boxes specifically about his hometown and the qualities of it. I mean, he really, maybe workshopping, I don't know, but it feels like he was really getting ready to talk about Opal City and all that. So it's if you've never read Firearm and you're a Starman fan, I strongly recommend you give it a shot. Then, of course, Zero Hour starts. I was working in a comic shop at the time, so I was all in on this, right? All of Zero Hour, all the crossovers, I was absolutely in. And Starman, I read that, I was hooked. And part of it's because the book was different, right? It felt more mature, like dense. I don't mean mature as in like explosions and nudity. I mean mature as in the topics, the subject matter, the way it's written, the time it takes to read it. You know, it feels a little bit like a hipster comic before we even knew the term, right? And I found the writing intriguing. The art was perfect. And Jack was such a cool guy, right? Here he is. He's this Gen X guy who has a love for pop culture and always throwing movie references. I mean, he's like us, you know, especially if you were growing up in the 90s and you were like in your 20s. He's just a regular guy like us. And he gets wrapped up in his own concerns. And his inner monologue reminds me of real people. And Jack was just kind of the kind of guy I wanted to hang out with. When I say he's like us, he's like us, but cooler. And working in the comic shop, I got my hands on a lot of the promo posters once we were done displaying them. So I had lots of Starman promo posters on my wall at home. Any Starman merch I could find, I was completely obsessed with that book. And I also got a chance to talk to James Robinson recently at the Baltimore Comic Con and had a chance to tell him how much his 90s work meant to me. I did go all fanboy. I don't care. It was a great moment. And I was telling Jose off air just a second ago, like, I haven't reread this entire series in I don't know, a couple of decades maybe? I don't know. Because I want to do a complete read through again, but it's like really daunting. Because, you know, if you look at that, what, 81 issues, you throw in the annuals and the crossovers and the specials and the tie-ins and all that, it's probably closer to 100 comics. And these are not comics that you can breeze through quickly, right? I mean, you have to pay attention. This comic requires you to work. It's dense, and I love that about it, but it's kind of a daunting task. So I'm kind of scared to start it over again. I don't know. Maybe I'm out there on my own. I don't know, but it's such an amazing series.
I love it. I will never, ever get tired of Starman. I can read it any point in the series and just feel that instant warmth and nostalgia.
It really is. It's something different. I mean, it's something special, and I don't know that we've seen the like of it since. I mean, certainly there's mature reader books. There's books that are written intelligently. There's a lot of independent stuff that's very good. But there's just something about this, because it's woven into the tapestry of mainstream DC. So he can meet Superman. He can meet Batman, all these things. And yet it lives in his own pocket world. And again, it's a book that you genuinely have to think about when you read it. And it's really something special. And I'm thrilled to be talking about this here.
I think a lot of people would credit the JSA series in the 90s does not happen without Starman.
Oh, 100%. 100% agree with that. Yeah. I mean, Starman proved there was popularity and appetite for JSA and Legacy. And if James Robinson hadn't been around to write the JSA, I doubt they would have launched it. I mean, they really launched it on his popularity. And it wouldn't have worked without that, without Starman laying the groundwork, for sure.
And the rare case of them letting a creator, an original book, go 80 issues. These days, they would cancel it maybe 15 or so and start over, or just let it go altogether.
I'll take you one step further. The amazing thing is they've never brought Jack back. Here's a book that, and I don't know what the creator situation is. I would assume it's like any other DC creation where DC owns the character. But the fact that they did those 81 issues, they sold like hotcakes, and then DC let them just walk away from it and never published Jack again. I think the only time we've seen Jack after that was in that, there was a JSA issue where Jack got to see, like, was watching Courtney graduate from high school, maybe? Was that what it was?
I think it was, yeah.
I think he was in the audience watching her graduate or something. Like, I burst out in tears when I saw him. I'm like, no!
I know he's in Sue's funeral in that series that we don't really talk about.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, let's talk about something happier. So let's talk about, well, I don't know if it's happy. It's pretty emotional, but let's get into this issue. So this is Starman number 27. If you want to see a few pages from it, you can go out to our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com. We're going to have a gallery page with a few pages, but for the most part, this is one of the more reprinted comics of the 90s. You should be able to find this or just check out a DC Unlimited, but it is cover dated February 1997, but it was on the shelves December 11th, 1996. Cover price was $2.25. Cover is by Tony Harris. You want to describe the cover for us?
Yes, I do. Jack is standing in front of a Christmas tree with the cosmic staff glowing, acting like the star on top. He's lifting his goggles with tears in his eyes as he sees a man in a Santa outfit sitting in the cold, snowy ground crying.
It's powerful, man. It is powerful. Now, if you know your magazine history, then you would know that this cover is absolutely an homage to Norman Rockwell and his Saturday Evening Post covers. Like, it's got this stark white background. It's got the circle motif in the middle. It's got this decorative title on a scroll with the Starman title and the holly and everything. And even Tony Harris's signature is an homage to Norman Rockwell's signature. And I'm a huge Norman Rockwell fan. Like, just outside of my office, I've got like 4 or 5 coffee table books of various Norman Rockwell stuff. I love it. And it's just so powerful. And the fact that the Saturday Evening Post covers he did were always a slice of Americana. And this is kind of that. I mean, it's you've got the Christmas tree, you've got Santa, except the contrast here, instead of Santa being jolly, he's crying. It's powerful. I should let you talk. What do you think of the cover, man?
It is powerful. You say a slice of Americana. I like to think it's a slice of opal, because you have the old deco background. You have the kind of, you know, a little depressing subject matter, but you still have that light with Jack. I think that's opal for me.
That makes a lot of sense. I love the cosmic rod as the Christmas star on the tree is great. And you're right. Jack adds a lot to it, because it's heartbreaking enough to see Santa, right, in tears. But then to see the sad expression on Jack's face just hits it home. Really great cover. Very powerful.
And anyone sitting in the cold in the snow crying is going to break your heart. It makes you want to know what is going to happen and how Jack's going to help this man.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's get inside. So it's written by James Robinson, art by Steve Yohl, inker is Wade Von Graubatcher, letter is Bill Oakley, colorist is Pat Guerra, and editor is Archie Goodwin. And the story is entitled Christmas Night. Again, that's night with a K. So I'm going to do a quick recap, and then we're just going to jump right into it. So this issue centers on a Christmas gathering at the O'Dare House, where the whole family of Opal City cops are coming together to celebrate. While the party kicks off, their guest Jack Knight Starman is running late. On his way, Jack spots a homeless man dressed as Santa crying on a park bench. His name is Pete. He's a veteran who's endured tragedy, addiction, and homelessness. He's devastated now due to the theft of his locket, which contained his only remaining photo of his now deceased wife and child. Jack sighs, but of course he knows he's going to help Santa. Jack tracks down the thief, recovers the locket, and along the way, Pete even uses his medic training to save an innocent life. Jack shows his heart, too, by buying food for the homeless folks down by the river, and Pete's wish is granted. But Jack goes even further. He brings Pete to the O'Dare family Christmas. Overwhelmed, Pete cries until Clarence O'Dea says, "No, Pete, no tears. Not tonight. Tonight's for smiles and laughter." Man, I want to hear your thoughts, but this thing is powerful. I read it 3 times this week getting ready for this episode. I cried all 3 times.
That no tears line gets me every time. It never fails. What interests me most is that this issue can be heartwarming and heartbreaking, and that's a very fine line to walk. Pete's not portrayed as a bad guy. He's just somebody who fell into hard times, and he lost his family. Even if it wasn't Christmas, that's still heartbreaking. And his only memento of his family gets stolen. Somebody robbed Santa. You know how messed up you have to be to do that?
And the interesting thing is, like, Pete has, like, this really big heart. Because at one point, he even actively says, "I'm trying not to hate the guys who stole my locket." Because he says winter's been hard on everyone. So here he is. You know, they beat him up. They took his locket. And he's trying not to be mad at the people for doing it. Wow. And later on, he goes on to do CPR to save an innocent man and save that guy's life. I mean, Pete's life has fallen apart. And yet he's still trying to do the right thing and be a good person. And it's just, wow.
Yeah, the trying not to hate them thing. I mean, until you said that, I mean, that really hits what kind of man that he was and is.
Yeah, there's no way I'd want to burn those people into the ground. There's no way I would have that kind of kindness and forgivingness. And how fitting that Santa on Christmas is doing that. And by the way, so we mentioned Pete's homeless, and the whole reason he's wearing the Santa outfit is he was ringing the bell in front of a department store. He got a job to ring the bell so he could make some money. Unfortunately, the department store janitors, they found his normal clothes and they reeked, because they do, and they threw them away because they thought they were trash. And so all Pete has is the Santa suit. So in fact, during the whole issue, Jack's just calling him Santa. We don't find out his name's Pete till almost the very end. So the whole issue is Jack's just calling him Santa, which adds sort of a, I don't know, kind of a nice Christmas spirit to it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The other thing I like about this is the other side of the story, where we have the party with the O'Dea family. And every time a sibling comes in, we get a little bit more of who they are as a character. Barry's trying to eat the frosting. Matt is actually trying to be a good O'Dea for once after so many family gatherings where he's just either not shown up or messed it up. He's actively trying here, and he tells Faith, "I want to be an O'Dea again."
That was really wonderful. And for me, because it's been so long since I read this, it was almost like I was reacquainting myself with the O'Dares. Like, I'd forgotten a lot of their various quirks, like the whole thing with Mason and Charity. And I just kind of forgotten a lot of the different aspects. It was all coming back to me. So that was probably, you're right. It's a great showcase for the whole supporting cast. Because again, you get all the O'Dares. Yeah, Ted Knight's there, right? Who's Jack's father and former Starman. Mikhail is there, who's this blue alien, is another former Starman. You get Charity, the fortune teller, and the Shade shows up. So it is a fantastic showcase for almost the entire supporting cast. And you forget a lot of times, because the book is Starman, you kind of forget how much of an ensemble cast there actually was.
And you know what's interesting? I noticed it in this issue. Faith hasn't met Jack yet. And we're 27 issues into this series. You'd think, given the Knight and the O'Dea kind of relationship, she would have met Jack at some point. I think this is the first time she's met him.
Yeah, that is sort of interesting, because he knows every single one of the other O'Dears. I guess because he always meets them in their police officer capacity rather than their personal capacity, must be what it is. And you mentioned Faith. I got to mention. So in the beginning, Clarence and Faith, they're in the kitchen getting ready. They're cooking food for the Christmas party. They're cracking jokes. And they have this fun banter where they're talking like they're from a Charles Dickens novel, which is so funny. And dude, it is completely laced with sexual innuendos between that couple, and it is hysterically funny. I could not stop laughing at that.
It's even funnier if you picture your parents trying to do that. And
I tried it with my wife. It wasn't going anywhere.
Thankfully, I'm single. I'm not trying it with anyone. I did also like the Shade gifted them a signed first edition of A Christmas Carol. That's a nice touch. Not only because of the holiday, it shows you how long the Shade's been around and the people that he knew.
It really is. I mean, it's such a nice nod for him to even, he's calling Charles Dickens by his first name. He's saying, you know, Charles gave me several copies. I mean, it's a nice reminder too, that of how much they changed the Shade. I mean, he's kind of a different character entirely in this book. I mean, certainly he's the Shade that was always fighting the Golden Age Flash, but really they changed the character dramatically in an amazingly positive way. And to see that here on the page is just great. I love it. If you mentioned Christmas Carol, I will mention too, like, one of the things I mentioned earlier, how much I like Jack and how he's always talking to pop culture references. Sure enough, there's caption boxes in this one where he's making references to the 1951 movie version of Christmas Carol. So always with the hipster side, that guy.
Yeah, definitely. That version, but I have other versions of A Christmas Carol I enjoy more.
I love Scrooged. I can't help myself. I absolutely adore that version.
That's one of that, the Patrick Stewart one and the Muppet one are my 3 go-tos every year.
There you go. All good stuff. Good stuff.
One other thing. I noticed Clarence tells Pete, "Happy Christmas." And I thought, is that a general term, or because Robinson's British, did he kind of get it mixed up like picture and portrait of Dorian Gray?
It's absolutely got to be the British thing, because I noticed the Happy Christmas is said several times in the issue. And then there's two other things that are very British. One is when they say they threw away Pete's clothes, they say they threw it because they thought it was rubbish. Well, rubbish is certainly in our lexicon as well. It's a very British word. Then when they're talking about waiting on Jack, it's like Jack's late and he's late and he's late for the party, and they're all doing toasts and they're starting to get drunk. And someone says, if we go too much longer, we'll be in our cups. Which is very much, at least in my experience, that's a British expression. Have you heard that very often here in the States?
No, and I watch a lot of British television, so that one's pretty new on me.
Oh, okay. I've heard it, but I watch a lot of British TV too, so I've heard it from British TV. I've never heard it in America. I ran it past my wife. She's like, I don't even know what that means. So I would definitely agree. I think Robinson is leaning on his British lexicon of words here, is what's happening in this issue for sure. A couple other quick things. Like Jack, this issue shows his generosity, right? I mean, he gives a homeless person $40. He offers the guy, first he says $20 for information, and the guy gives him info, so he gives him $40 instead because it's Christmas, tells the guy to get something warm, and then he gives this one guy who actually jumped Pete, essentially a bad guy, he gives the guy $150 and says, go buy food, something warm for everyone that's living there, the homeless people under the bridge. I mean, and Jack, you think about it, he owns, let's just call it a junk shop, whatever you want to call it, but that's a lot of stuff to sell. And in 1990s dollars, it's a lot more money than it is nowadays too. So incredible generosity from him. And it just makes me love Jack even more.
I love that he offered to give the money so that everybody under that bridge could have something to eat that night. Because it would have been easy just to give the one guy that one thing. But he wanted to make sure everybody who was under there got something to eat.
And of course, what goes through my head is I'm really hoping that guy does follow through and doesn't keep the money for himself. But it's Christmas, so I'm going to assume he does.
Better. That's a lot of money.
Right. So the artwork, I just want to talk about the artwork in general. So this is not Tony Harris. This is Steve Yule, which is a different kind of style. But he's got some really good pages in here that I enjoy. There's some close-ups of Jack's face, which are really important. And I think we can talk about those in a minute. There's a lot of great layouts. I mean, it's nothing fancy. It's not someone that's going to blow you away, but it's solid storytelling. And it's very stylistic. And I really like it. I actually met Steve Yule many, many, many years ago, over 30 years ago, when he was doing a Vertigo book called Sebastian O. And he was such a nice guy. And I think that helped me to appreciate his artwork even more, and the simplicity, because it looks simple on the surface, but there's really a lot going on with it. And I just really enjoy it.
Kind of the middle ground between Tony Harris and Peter Sjöberg. I think that's how you say it.
Something like that. Yeah, I can see that.
It's a nice middle ground.
Yeah. And that last page is another Norman Rockwell homage, by the way. You know, the family carrying the turkey to the table, everyone all around it. So that's sort of another nod to Norman Rockwell, which is, again, perfect for Christmas because Rockwell did so many Christmas covers.
I also like to think Clarence helped Pete find a job later on, or just tried to do something to help him out. Like this one night just wasn't just inviting Pete to eat and everything. He actually wanted to help him.
I hope you're right. I actually thought about it because I was thinking about the story at the end of it. And I'm like, okay, at the end of the day, Pete's still homeless. What happens tomorrow? And I hope you're right. I hope Clarence or one of the folks found something and helped him get back on his feet. I hope that's what happens. All right. So now it is time for the All-Star Award. This is where we nominate our favorite moments from the issues, whether it's a story beat, something in the yard, something that's made us laugh, whatever it is. Both myself and Jose will pick one moment from the issue to spotlight, and each of those will earn an All-Star Award. Jose, you're the guest, so why don't you tell me, what is your moment to nominate for the All-Star Award?
It is on page 18. It's a 3-panel shot of Jack standing in the snow. The first panel, full body. The second, we zoom in towards torso. And the final panel, we get in on Jack's face, but there's tears streaming down his eyes. This is when he realizes he can't let Pete walk out in the snow on his own. And the reason I love this, not only is it a great characterization for Jack, it reminds me of that Steve Martin part in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, where he's piecing together what happened with Dell and why he can't leave Dell alone by himself either. It's good men figuring something out and thinking, I have to do something to help them. And I love that moment. It's done with no words, It's just three simple panels, and I love it.
I had a feeling you were going to pick that, because I would have picked that as well. Because you're right, it's the best moment of the comic. Absolutely, yeah. It's the moment of realization, and it's incredible. So I picked it. I had a backup, so I will go to my backup, which is also, similarly, Good Men deciding they have to do the right thing. It's on, oh, I don't know, there's no page numbers here, so what is this? I guess it's page 3, where it's a series of panels. It's after the O'Dares are in the kitchen, almost getting it on through Charles Dickens. But it's the first time we see Jack. Jack's flying over the city, and he's in his head, and the captions are talking about him, you know, watching this Alistair Sim Christmas movie and what he's got to do, and he's running late. And then he comes down, he says, damn, now I know I'm going to be late. And how can I not stop and see what's wrong when Santa Claus is crying? And I just feel like those four panels and then the next page, it's a great snapshot of who Jack is, right? He's running late. He's in his head. He's thinking about pop culture references. He's in a hurry. He forgot to do something. And at the same time, he sees something that's wrong and he knows he has to do something about it. And so I just feel like that's a great little snapshot of who Jack is. And it makes me miss him that much more. So I've got a Jack Knight action figure in my in a little display cabinet right next to my desk. And when I think about Jack, it's moments like that that really resonate for me.
I love that moment because, yeah, that is a very good representation of Jack. It's also kind of reminiscent of his father. You have these two men who are very much into their own thing, but when somebody needs help, they're going to stop and they're going to do what's right. I see a lot of Ted in that moment as well.
All right. Well, congratulations to both of those moments. You're going home with an All-Star Award. It is as tangible as our love for the moment, so please wear it with pride. Now, we're going to do a quick special feature here that we started this last year as well, which is where we each name another holiday-themed comic book story from any era. It doesn't have to be from the 90s that we want to kind of put out there in the ether so other people go out and read it. What do you got, buddy?
I have Adventures of Superman 462 titled Homeless for the Holidays. And similar to our story tonight, it deals with a really serious issue, homelessness. I didn't intend for that to happen, but what makes this issue so special is the character of Alice. She was a background character for a long time in the Superbooks, and we get little hints here and there that something was going on with her. We find out in this issue, she's been living in the Daily Planet storeroom for 3 years. Her mother fell on hard times, and sadly, Alice lost her place. She had nowhere else to go, so she's been hiding in the Daily Planet storeroom, taking showers in the clubs, and just getting food where she can. And much like this story, our hero finds out, gathers a supporting cast to pitch in, help out, and get Alice back on her feet. And for some reason, I don't know why, it makes me cry every time I read it.
You're not the only one, man. I reread that issue, I think, for Christmas last year. It was incredibly powerful. That issue came out about the time I started collecting Superman. I can't remember if it was right before or right after, but either way, I read that one very early in my Superman collecting. It is always imprinted on my mind. I very much remember Alice. I remember that powerful story. I reread it for around the holidays last year as well. It's a great one. Great pick, man, and so emotionally moving. And you're right, I didn't even think about the thematically tied into this issue as well.
If you look at Clarence and Faith O'Dare and Perry and his wife, also named Alice, they're all about family and they want to make sure nobody gets left behind. The O'Dares want to invite Pete for Christmas dinner. The Whites want Alice to stay with her until she gets back on her feet. It's just good people helping out when somebody's in need. That's Christmas to me. I love it.
Couldn't have said it better, man. Nah, that's, you're right. And good comparison. So my pick is actually something that's brand new. I decided to pick DC's I Saw Ma Hunkle Kissing Santa Claus, which just came out a month ago. It was released on November 26, 2025. It's on the DC Infinite app now, or you can find it in your comic shops. I picked this specific story in there that's JSA related. I thought, why not? It features Ma Hunkle. Now, the whole collection also has stories from Captain Marvel and Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy and Animal Man and Dr. Light, Galaxy, Supergirl and Martian Manhunter. But I wanted to specifically point out the Ma Hunkle story because it's JSA, right? And it's very sweet. It takes place in the 1940s, and Ma Hunkle is trying to cheer up Amelia, which is one of her sidekicks in the Cyclone Kids. Amelia's sad because they're poor and they can't celebrate Christmas like the other families. Well, Ma Hunkle dresses up like Red Tornado and takes Amelia around to the other JSA members to show her how special their extended family is. So they visit folks like Dr. Fate and Alan Scott Green Lantern, Hawkman and Hawkgirl, the Spectre, Johnny Thunder and his Thunderbolt. Ultimately, Amelia's heart is finally lifted when she helps another less fortunate child, and she can't imagine a better Christmas. So, again, DC's I Saw Ma Hunkle Kissing Santa Claus. The name's hilarious. It's got Ma Hunkle right on the cover, so I definitely recommend you guys check that out. It's a lot of fun.
I love that DC is doing these holiday specials, and we get spotlights on characters like Ma Hunkle. Because we get a lot of attention in the past 20 years or so. I know definitely she got referenced on Smallville and Absolute Justice. And she was in that JSA series. And I just love that Ma Hunkel is getting some attention because she's kind of like that. You know how we say Jay Garrick is that uncle you kind of love to see? Mm-hmm. She's like that grandmother you're happy to see.
She totally is. I mean, she was definitely the den mother or grandma to the JSA in that 2000 series once she finally joined the book. Absolutely. And I adore her. So good.
Was there a JSA cover also like Rockwell? I vaguely remember something like a Thanksgiving one. Was that a Rockwell reference?
So there's a couple. So there's definitely a Thanksgiving one where Power Girl's bringing in the turkey. But what you're kind of thinking of is probably JSA number 55. I know it well. We covered it a few years ago in the show here. It's Wildcat sitting on Santa's lap. It looks like a Rockwell cover as well. And that is actually the issue where Ma Hunkel comes back into the after being out of publication history for decades. That's where Ma Hunkel comes in and she joins the JSA as the curator for the museum.
I think that's the one I'm thinking of. Yeah, I remember because I was in BMCC when that came out. Yeah, wow.
It's a hell of a great Christmas issue, folks. Again, we covered it a couple Christmases back on this very show on Justice Society Presents, so you can check that out if you want, but it's a great issue. Now, Jose, I need to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging out here for a bit and keeping the O'Dare family company during the Christmas dinner? I mean, they seem to have already taken everyone in from Opal City, so I'm sure one more person won't be a problem.
Of course. I'll sneak Drake. I'll sneak some frosting, all while Clarence or Faith are in the kitchen playing Cratchit verbal foreplay.
Well, perfect. Well, don't worry, Jose. We'll bring you back at the end of the show. But after this podcast promo break, I'll be joined by our second co-host this episode to discuss a holiday story about The Flash from 1992.
I am vengeance. I am the knight. I am Batman.
You need to take out the trash.
I don't have time for that now. We have two podcasts I have to create a new promo for.
What? Both JLU Cast and Supermates?
Yes. JLU Cast, where you and I discussed the Justice League and Justice League Unlimited animated series from Bruce Timm and Company.
And Supermates, our original show where we talk about all sorts of geeky stuff, including our annual House of Frankenstein series on classic horror films. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's it. But how do we combine this into one promo?
I have no idea, but it sounds like we're doing our original Supermates promo all over again.
I kind of think we are, but hey, other folks kind of aped it, so it must have worked.
Well, why don't you get to work taking out the trash, and I'll finish up.
Great.
So join us, Cindy.
And Chris.
On JLU Cast and Supermates, both proudly part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network, found at fireandwaterpodcast.com and on iTunes.
Hi, I'm Eric, host of the Long Box Review podcast. I love comic books so much that I started Long Box Review to celebrate my love for them and connect with others who share my passion. Each month, I critique the comics I've read and present other topics such as spotlights on specific issues, my comics history, the Legion Project with Peter Rios, where we discuss the Legion of Superheroes, and so much more. Additionally, the Long Box Review podcast feed includes The Gutters, my audio journal, and Center Seat, my Star Trek podcast. The Long Box Review website also examines comic books outside of the podcast, such as the series 52, Justice, and others. Please join me as I celebrate nearly 50 years of comic book reading and over 15 years of podcasting. You can visit longboxreview.com for more information. And thanks for listening.
We're back from break, and I'm here with our second co-host for this episode, who is a good friend to the Fire & Water Podcast Network. He's also he's also a massive fan of the Wally West Flash, and he's doing a complete read-through of all of Wally's adventures. And this gentleman, and I use the term loosely, is a teacher, a thespian, a podcaster, and a pretty decent chauffeur. Folks, please help me welcome Mr. Steve Givens. Welcome to the holidays at the JSA Brownstone, Steve. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
I'm doing all right, Shag. Thank you for having me here today. And I am indeed a teacher, a thespian, a podcaster, and under your tutelage, being the best backseat driver I've ever had, I am a great chauffeur now. Thank you.
I think I gave you 5 stars on Lyft, so, you know, it wasn't too bad.
Well, you're just lucky I didn't drive you over that cliff I was telling you about. So,
you know, having to listen to your stories, it felt like it. So,
no.
Oh, a rainy weekend in Delaware, and Steve drove us everywhere because he's a super champ, and we love him for it.
Well, it was either that or leave you guys standing out in the rain. And it was you and Ryan and his lovely wife. And really, it was her that I wanted to drive around, because the two of you, I'm like, you could have just walked in the rain. But I couldn't leave a lovely woman standing on the sidewalk in the rain. So
that is,
you
know, true.
She saved your bacon in that one.
and the tuxedos we were wearing. So
yes.
Well, folks, we are here to discuss another holiday issue. We're going to discuss Mark Waid's Flash, issue number 73 from 1992, which is a story featuring Wally teaming up with Jay Garrick in a story entitled One Perfect Gift. Now, before we get into that, I do got to ask you, what is your personal origin story with The Flash? Now, this could be any Flash, but I definitely want to know about Jay Garrick as well.
Sure. Well, those of you who know me, I've been on a few of the shows, and I've also, people know me in my real life, know that I am a big Flash fan, particularly Wally West fan. I've got a cat named Flash. You know, I've got all sorts of Flash memorabilia in my home and also in my classroom. My students certainly know that I'm a Flash fanatic. But the first Flash I remember having any awareness of, though, is because of I'm of a certain age, is Barry Allen. He was the first Flash I ever encountered. But I don't remember exactly when I first encountered his version. Maybe it was like Super Friends, on the Challenge of the Super Friends TV series. I know I always had comics going back since before I could read. So I'm sure that I encountered the Flash there. But I did have, and I think this will make Chris Franklin very happy, I had that classic Super Friends bedsheet set that featured the Flash. And I think it was art by Carmine Infantino. And if I'm not mistaken, you know, but again, Chris would probably know better than I would. Do you know the bedsheet set I'm talking about, Shag?
I don't, but I'm super interested in that now. That sounds so cool.
Well, do a Google search for it, or go ask Chris, because he's the memorabilia guy. He knows all the stuff that's out there.
He's probably still got him on one of the beds in the guest room or something.
I wouldn't doubt it. However, now, interestingly, I do remember my first encounter with Jay Garrick, though. It was in the best JLA-JSA team-up ever, at least in my opinion. JLA 195 through 197, where they fight the Secret Society of Supervillains.
Woohoo!
I've talked about this ad nauseum before. I remember you guys gave me a lot of crap on our George Perez tribute episode that we did, because I kept going back to JLA 195 as being a seminal work of George Perez. But it was those issues that I can go back and say that they made me a reader, and I'm not exaggerating. Like, they ignited the love of reading in me, which then parlayed into me becoming a teacher, me loving literature and writing and reading and whatnot. So, I mean, it's kind of, I can pinpoint that moment as kind of setting me on a trajectory of where I am today in my life. With that said, I didn't mean to get all philosophical there, but specifically, I remember Jay in the last issue of 197, where the images that, you know, of course, Perez, nobody's better at drawing, you know, a group of heroes fighting and interacting with each other. He was using Ragdoll as a punching bag and then creating a whirlwind to send Ragdoll and the Mist into that limbo chamber thing. But here's the thing, though. Oddly, I didn't register Jay as being from an alternate Earth. I don't think as a six-year-old reading that or trying to read it, I didn't get the idea of like multiple Earths or whatever. But here's the weird thing. I remembered being puzzled by the different look, but I guess I just thought it was just that particular Flash being used in that individual story. Like, I knew the other iterations of characters like Superman and Batman existed because they've been around for a long time. Like, I knew that Superman back in the day, like, I didn't necessarily know he came out in 1938, but I knew like the one from the 40s and the 50s looked different than the Superman I knew from the Christopher Reeve films and the comic books. I knew there was a difference. Like, there was an evolution in the characters.
Yeah, makes sense.
But so I realized that. Plus, with all the comics and the TV shows and the movies that were coming out at the time, especially, like I just said, the Christopher Reeve movies, I think that as a six-year-old, I was used to the idea that the characters were going to be different depending on the medium that they were in. Like, I was okay with that for some reason. Like, it just was like, okay, this is what Superman looks like in the movie, or this is what General Zod looks like in the movie, but he looks different in the comic, you know? So with Jay being in that particular story, I guess I just went with the flow, you know? Like, I don't remember thinking, oh, this is the Golden Age Flash, and he's from Earth 2. It's just like, oh, this is the Flash in this story. And, you know, I guess I was just like a pretty Zen six-year-old. I don't know. Now, I do have a memory, though, and this is one of those weird, no pun intended, like flash memories.
Oh.
No, I know, right? Shut up. But it's like one of those memories I have. It's like of a poster print that was on some sort of wooden plaque, and it was featuring the cover of Flash Comics number one. And for those of you who don't know what that is, that's the cover where Jay is speeding through the image, and he's catching a bullet before it hits who was at the time Joan Williams, but later becomes Joan Garrick, his wife. It's a very famous image. And anyone who sees it will know exactly, anybody like comic book fan who sees it will know exactly what I'm talking about. I remember that being in the garage of my childhood home. It was placed with some other yard sale looking junk. And here's the thing. I don't know where it came from or if someone had given it to one of my parents to give to me. But I was, you know, very young and probably didn't show too much interest in it. But that memory has stayed with me. Like, it's something that has lingered with me in some way, shape, or form.
How wild. Because, I mean, just
yeah.
There wasn't that much merchandise for especially Golden Age comics back then. So here's a dumb question. It couldn't have been like an actual issue of Flash number one.
I do remember holding it. I would be having a very different conversation. I think I would be... I'd be very depressed if I bypassed Flash Comics number one. No, it was, I remember holding it and it being like something like a plaque that you would put on the wall.
Sure,
you
know? Right, yeah.
Not sure where it came from in terms of like, the merchandise and memorabilia. Yeah, I keep thinking that was a very odd thing to have, unless it was something that somebody like got a poster, you know, and put it on that on the wooden backing to make it look like a plaque type of thing. But
that's anyhow, wild.
Yeah. So I do have that memory. But as for my favorite Flash, you know, it's far and away Wally West. I became more familiar with Wally, I think, like most comic book readers in the 80s through the New Teen Titans. And then, you know, I started reading comics authentically, I guess you could say. I started collecting right at the time when Crisis started. So obviously Wally featured prominently in that one. It's where he first became the Flash after Barry's death. Then I followed that right into Legends. When he got his own series, I started picking it up because I was reading a lot of DC at the time. And slowly, and I gave this story before when I was on an episode of JLU podcast. Here's the thing that happened. Wally became a favorite character of mine, and I didn't even realize it. It was happening. His series became a top read for me. Like, it was always at the top of my pile of comics. You know, back in the day, you always had that pile of comics and you would rearrange them in the order that you want to read them, you know, because maybe you want to save the best for last, or maybe you wanted to read the best first or whatever. Mm-hmm. But for me, I was always, let me read the best first. And so Flash was always at the top. And it remained that way right up until the series Ignominious End, which I don't know if I want to talk about or not, because I've been doing a reread of The Flash, like you said. The first ending of the series, I was like, was a big wah-wah.
Yeah.
You know? And then with it was brought back, there was like a brief, you know, shining light when Mark Waid came back, and then it kind of peters out again. Yeah. So that's my history with The Flash in a nutshell, as succinctly as I could put it.
No, I appreciate you sharing that and keeping it to less than 2 hours, which you're most well known for. And it's what a great story about that plaque in your garage. And then, of course, the love for Wally, because I'll share a little bit on my side. Like, I've already covered my Jay Garrick history on previous episodes, so I'm not really going to go into that. Although I will say, just today, like a flash memory, as you say, came to me that up until a few years ago, I guess, I owned a long sleeve red shirt that was a Jay Garrick shirt. It had the Jay Garrick lightning bolt on. I completely forgot about it until today. I bought it sometime in the 90s. I had it sometime into the 2000s. I don't know when I eventually got rid of it. I know it fell apart. And the only reason I know when I had it more recently is because I found a picture of it on my own blog just tonight. But loved that shirt to death. And so Jay's obviously important to me. But specific to Wally, I mean, he is my favorite Flash. Just period. You know, obviously Barry Allen was important. But to me, Barry Allen is best when he's dead. And he's an inspiration to others. I think that's when Barry functions is his best. So for me, Wally West is the Flash.
And you know what, Shag? For once in your life, you are absolutely right. It's a Christmas miracle.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. All right. Well, let's get into this. So we are going to talk about Flash number 73. If you want to see a few pages from this, you can go out to the Fire and Water Podcast Network. We have a gallery post there. I'll post a couple of pictures there. But I mean, you can find this thing in a lot of places. It's collected several times. It's Mark Waid's early part of his run. You can get it on DC Unlimited. There's a million places you can read this thing. So I'll only post a couple of pages. Obviously published by DC Comics. Cover date is February 1993, but it was on the shelves December 15th, 1992. Cover price is $1.25, five shiny quarters. The cover's by Greg Laroque and Roy Richardson. You want to describe the cover for us?
Do I have to?
Well, it is part of your job, and I didn't ask you to do much.
Well, okay, Shag. All right. For you, I will. So, like you already said, the art is by the wonderful Greg Laroque. It features Wally and Jay running towards the reader through a snowy cityscape. And the caption reads, "Dashing through the snow." And but neither Wally nor Jay look very festive. Like, you think that you hear like a little caption of "dashing through the snow," you're like, but no, they're not. They're both looking very grim and serious. It is interesting to note that this era of DC Comics featured the full body miniatures of the characters underneath the DC Bullet masthead in the upper left-hand corner. When I saw that, I was like, oh yeah, this was that period of time during DC Comics when they were doing that. So, oh gosh, I hesitate in saying this because I really love Laroque on this series. I thought he did a great job. And to me, he's one of the classic artists for Flash, or at least one who is someone who comes to mind when I think of, like, when I think back on reading The Flash as a kid. But overall, I have to say this cover to me is not very dynamic. And it's telling for me because when I looked at this, I could immediately think of a couple of different other covers that Laroque did that were just much more dynamic, much more energized and exciting to see. And I'm looking at this like, oh, they're just kind of just, I know that they don't even look like they're speeding. They just kind of like, hey, we're out for a grim jog through the snow, you know?
Yeah, it's a little interesting because like the pose implies physically that they are running, but there's no motion lines. There's nothing to actually suggest any speed. I mean, there's a little snow being thrown up by their feet, but that's really it. And sort of like what you said, the more I look at it, the more weird it looks. It just doesn't look right. Now, Greg Laroque's never really been one of my favorite Flash artists, but there is something about him drawing Wally in that shiny suit with the opaque eyes that brings me joy, though, because this was the era when I started reading the book. I started Flash. I mean, I bought a handful of issues here and there, but I started buying Flash regularly when Mark Waid took over in the, Born to Run storyline, I think is what it was called. And so Laroque was drawing it then. So even though he's not necessarily one of my favorites, it still makes me happy because it reminds me of this wonderful time when I fell in love with the book.
Yeah. This cover, I'm like, it's nice. And it's great to see Jay because if memory serves, this was the first time that Jay was featured in a present day story in the series. He'd been in flashbacks, but this was like the first time since he came back from Ragnarok or something.
You're absolutely correct. The 1992 Justice Society America series, which we just finished covering in the show, was only on issue 6 at this time. So that means, Jay had only been back from Ragnarok for about 6 months. So yeah, this is the first time he shows up in the Flash book, and it's a great usage of him too.
Thank you for confirming that I'm correct, Shag. I appreciate that.
Oh, I walked right into that one, man. Well, they also put it across the top, guest starring the original Scarlet Speedster, which is nice.
Yes, yes, yes. And, you know, and it's cool. I mean, I remember picking this off the shelves and thinking, oh, this is a Christmas issue. It's got Jay in it. Let's see. I mean, I didn't like think at the time, oh, this is going to be a crap story because this cover isn't great. I was like, oh, cool. It's going to have Jay Garrick. Let's see what happens, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we spent a lot of time talking about the cover. We should get in the inside. But I mean, the cover is perfectly serviceable. It's just the more you stare at it, the more you... As you do on a podcast, you pick things apart. It's what happens. All right, let's do the inside here. So, all right.
Sure, absolutely.
Writer is Mark Waid. Penciler is Greg Laroque. Inker is Roy Richardson. Letterer is Timothy Harkins. Colorist is Matthew Hollingsworth. Editor is Brian Augustine. The issue itself is called One Perfect Gift. And so I'll do a quick summary and then we'll just get into a discussion. So it's Christmas Eve and Wally West and his girlfriend Linda are spending the holiday with Jay and Joan Garrick. Wally's too restless to sit still, so he and Jay suit up and take a run through the city helping folks along the way. They save a pregnant woman, Maria, from being hit by a car. She's about to give birth and tells them her husband, Joey, who's desperate after losing his job, has been convinced to rob Boone's department store with some shady criminals. Jay stays with Maria during the delivery of her baby, while Wally races off to stop Joey, who's a temporary employee at Boone's. The store is packed on Christmas Eve, and Wally can't identify Joey, but he realizes the temporary position for Joey is as the department store Santa. So Joey has already taken the money when a little boy asks Santa for a gift to cheer up his grieving mother. That reminder of family makes Joey want to return the cash, but his shady partners pull guns. Wally arrives just in time, saves the day, and reunites Joey with Maria, who just had her baby. Back home, Wally's Christmas night ends with the greatest gift of all. Barry Allen, alive and well, standing at the door. Dun-dun-dun-dun!
No.
That's a whole separate discussion. But anyway, well, why don't we get into this thing? Tell me your thoughts.
All right, cool. Well, first of all, if I remember correctly, this is an issue where the Wally-Linda relationship is fully a thing now. Like, they're together. It's still a developing. In my reread of the series, one of the things I really loved about it was how their relationship is developed. It's, you know, I remember when she first appears as a reporter, and then she builds into a stronger supporting character, and they have a growing attraction with each other, and then they begin this relationship, and obviously later she becomes his wife and the mother of his children. I don't know if there's any other relationship in comics that has been allowed to develop like that over a span of years, in terms of like having clear development and changes that were just seem to be a natural part of the progression of the characters. You know, it's I don't know how with the multitude of writers, and I know mostly Mark Waid is should be given the credit for this, but it's just one of those things I'm always just impressed by whenever I take a look back at the series. Like, gosh, they really built a strong relationship between Wally and Linda. So there's that. So the opening scene with the two of them at the Christmas tree, and Wally can't get the Christmas tree together. and Linda's just like, you know, come on, pull it together. Some of us need to watch football. You know, that's, to me, that was the beginning of what has turned out to be a really, one of the best romantic relationships in comics that I've ever encountered.
The only other couple I would add real quick that might be on par would be like Clark and Lois, because of how far that developed. They had a kid together. Yeah, sure. I guess Peter and Mary Jane too, but that got mostly wiped away. So yeah, I would say Clark and Lois would be out the closest.
Possibly, but even then with Clark and Lois, there seemed to be a conscious effort to move them forward. Like, their marriage was a big deal. Like, it became like, let's coincide it with the Lois and Clark TV series. And then, you know, the fact that they have a son, that was part of a big DC event, you know, that.
That's true.
You know, but with Wally and Linda, it just seemed to be a very natural progression in the series where you don't, at some level, you don't even realize it's happening, you know? Anyhow. You're right, but that's the distinction that I would make between the two. But anyway, going on, page two brings to mind a scene in a later issue. Now, I don't remember what issue it was, but it's one where Impulse has been introduced, and he's buzzing around in the kitchen or something, and Iris is back, and she's trying to explain to Wally why she needs him to help tutor and to educate Bart in how to be a speedster, and she says, because they are exactly alike, and this and then with this scene with Wally popping back into the kitchen constantly, asking if he could help, trying to rush Joan along with the dinner preparation. You know, I was like, oh yeah, that's Bart. That's why Iris was like, yeah, he needs to, Wally needs to teach Bart because he's got like a ADHD. He's got like no ability to be patient, and he wants to always be at doing things at a fast pace. So I reread this page and just chuckled to myself, but also gave me that great memory of that scene with Bart.
It's funny, we both came to that independently. I was thinking the same thing about, like, you know, go forward a couple of years, this scene would have been done with Bart. I'd forgotten about the actual scene with that, but that's funny.
Yeah.
But the thing that, it's a beautiful page. It's six repeating panels. It's the exact same focus of the kitchen. Just little tiny things have moved, like Joan moves a little or Jay moves a little bit. It's almost like repeating panels, and that's what makes the comedy work. It's just Wally being so irritating because he's like, you know, now, can I help? And it's just hilarious. And you know, Joan's finally line of like, you know, get him out of the house before I kill him, which is great. And
which is made funnier by the fact that the whole time she's been saying these wonderful grandmotherly things things about Wally. She's like, I love him dearly. He's always so well-meaning. And, oh, I'm sure, dear. Yeah, I don't need your help. She's like, get him out of here before I kill him.
Well, it's a good reminder to us, too, that, you know, Jay and Joan, at least at this point, you know, couldn't have children. And yeah. So their house probably does feel a bit lonely. And I mean, really, Joan's had the house to herself now for years. Having Jay back is great. And then having Wally there with his girlfriend. So it just, you know, obviously, until the boom comes along, Jay and Joan could never have kids. And Wally was kind of like their adopted nephew. So it's sweet. And Seeing Wally and Jay and Joan together in a suburban family setting always brings me joy.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. The next point I found, and this goes back to our discussion on the cover page. On page 3, there's a semi-splash page because it's interrupted by a panel at the top. But I looked at this, and I was like, this should have been the cover.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, because they are smiling. Jay is more in the forefront, which would have been fit more with the caption of the return of the original Scarlet Speedster. And Wally is back from him a little bit, but looking at him with admiration. And it seems, and again, this one doesn't have the speed lines, but it looks so much more dynamic.
Yeah, you know? And I think part of what it may be, too, some of the times those covers are drawn months in advance. And So LaRocque might have been still figuring out where he wanted everything to work. And by the time he gets to do the inside, he's got it laid out better. And that could be something as simple as that. One of the things I like on this page is Jay keeps calling Wally Jr. Mm-hmm. And that keeps going on and on. And it's cute in the story. But as you read along after this issue into the Return of Barry Allen storyline, him calling him Jr. and then him stopping calling him Jr. Is a very specific plot point. And I really like how that plays out.
Absolutely. Which that speaks to Mark Waid's writing. Speaking of that, you know, this whole interaction between Jay and Wally, it features a characteristic of speedsters that I believe originated with Mark Waid. And I love it to death. It's their ability to multitask. Wally and Jay are having this like very natural grandfather, grandson style chat about relationships in the holiday season. But all the while they're saving people from catastrophe while they're doing it.
Yes.
It's like and they're not even like really breaking a sweat or losing step in their conversation while they're doing it. You know, you have Wally helps a woman who has dropped her Christmas gifts. They are shoveling snow for somebody. And then finally, it ends with Wally saving Maria, and it starts the main plot moving with her giving birth and Wally having to go find Joey. But I love that little character-driven bit where this is what it's like to live life as a speedster. Your mind works faster, your body moves faster, and so obviously you're able to do multiple things at once. And if you're doing this with a fellow speedster, you guys can just keep in step with each other the whole time. Which is, I think, is a really cool aspect of the speedster family. You know, it's just one of those little touches that I've always loved about Mark Waid's run on the book.
It's also a really clever writing technique as well, because you're getting two things, doubling your bang for your buck, because you're getting the characters just having a conversation that they could be having at a diner. You know, it's just a very casual conversation. He's getting a point across, but at the same time, you're feeding the need for the reader wanting action. And so you're getting lots of action in the same way. So it's a really clever writing technique, and it's very impressive. Now, I did want to talk about that conversation for a second. So the whole conversation is going back and forth between Wally and Jay about Christmas gifts. And Wally's admitting that he knows he's a grown-up now, and he knows that the Christmas is different now. It's more about family, and it's about friends, and it's about, you know, responsible gifts, you know, like sweaters or scarves or whatever. But he's talking about how he misses that thrill of getting, like, a joyous gift, like a baseball glove, which, ironically, by the end, you know, Linda gives him a baseball glove. It's wonderful. But I find it to be a very interesting and honest discussion because, you know, we're old. I don't know if you've looked in the mirror lately, but we're a little older now, too. And yes, the holidays are about friends. They are about family. They are about responsibility. But I can still understand that that feeling. And I don't mean it in a selfish way, but I can remember the excitement of getting a new Star Wars toy on Christmas. And it's just acknowledging the nostalgia. It's not a selfishness. And so I think it's a nice sort of honest conversation for a guy, you know, a Gen X guy in his 20s, Wally is, where he's like, well, you know, I don't get anything cool anymore. And I think that's okay. It's a very real conversation.
Yeah. I think that's remains true going into as we get older. And it is still nice to get a gift that someone has thought about that you really wanted. You know, I've had that experience as an adult. Like, if somebody gives me something that I was like, oh my gosh, I really wanted this, or this is something that's really special and cool. You know, I mean, now mostly I get gifts from my cats. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right. That doesn't go away. It's special to get the kind of like a cool gift. So I get that.
Now, the use of Maria, the pregnant woman, I mean, it's a pregnant woman who delivers a baby at Christmas time. To find her, they find the church with a shining light. I mean, it's very trope heavy, but that's okay. It works. At no point did I read this and like groan or roll my eyes or like, oh, she's in the manger. I mean, there's none of that, but I mean, it works really, really well. I liked it.
Yeah. There was no, in terms of, like you said, the tropes and the story being told, like Mark Waid was not like pulling out like a rabbit trick of originality here. You know, mm-hmm. he wasn't. And I'm not saying that to drag the writing. It was, like you said, it works and it's fine. I think what makes the issue work so well are those character moments that are specific to Wally and Jay, like the interaction they have at home, the conversation that Jay and Wally are having before all the action hits. And also like those moments that Waid writes in for the characters, or for the minor characters, like Joey. You know, I made a note of this on page 17. After he has confronted the guys he's supposed to be robbing the store for, and they pull out guns and are like shooting at him, you know, Wally shows up and saves the day. We all get that. But what always has struck me, and this struck me at the time when I first read this in the 90s, Joey is shielding that child he has with him. He has turned his back to the robbers and is trying to protect the boy from the gun. He doesn't know Wally is coming. He doesn't know the Flash is going to be there to save him. He thinks he's about to die and he's trying to save the kid. And, you know, this is where I think in terms of an artist, LaRock really shines, that look of anguish and anticipation of pain. I don't know what else you would describe it that is on Joey's face.
Yep.
It's just a powerful image. And of course, you get the speed lines and zipping in, and you as a reader, you know what's happening. Wally has caught all the bullets. But it's just moments like that. I don't know if LaRock did that or if it was a Waid thing in his script, but having Joey like save that child and shield that child, you know, it makes you think. Up until that point for me in the story, I was like, Joey, you're making bad choices. I don't have a lot of sympathy for you, dude. I mean, you've got a wife and child and you're going to rob somebody and put yourself in jail. I mean, you're kind of a dumb schlub here. Mm-hmm. But then when he does that, when he saves the child, you're like, okay, this is a good guy. This guy needs to be protected. And that's what Wally ends up doing, is protecting him. Although I couldn't help but, this is the theater nerd coming out in me here.
Oh, no.
when Wally tells Joey about that fact that he's about to become a father and Maria is giving birth, he sends Joey off and he's like shouting Maria, Maria, like he is auditioning for Tony in West Side Story. He's going through the streets. And, I laugh, but, you know, it's endearing. It's endearing. And he finally gets to the church. But then I love the fact that on page 19, it's just the one Maria in a word balloon. And then the remaining panels are silent as Jay shows Joey to Maria and their newborn child. You know, it's simple. It's, again, it goes back to being a skillful writer and a skillful artist. Like, you know, when the images can speak better than the words would. And so it's just, I mean, it's not the only, obviously Waid is not the only writer to have done it. LaRock is not the only artist to have done that. It's the mark of a skilled storyteller when you know that that's the thing that needs to happen in that moment. And I think it's great.
Oh, so making it wordless is brilliant. And it's power. It makes it that much more powerful.
Sure.
And yeah, it is the combination of Waid and LaRock working in perfect sync there. And I love that it's Jay, because Jay is an older mentor type of character. Mm-hmm. And he brings Joey to the child, you know, and it's a beautiful moment. You're absolutely right. It's great. Mm-hmm. I was speaking of Jay and all that. I did want to mention one thing too. So what happens is, you know, Maria tells them this situation, and they decide they need to split up. So Jay decides to stay with Maria and the baby, and Wally runs off to go stop Joey. Well, there's this great page. It's the top three panels. They're widescreen panels, and mm-hmm. in the panel, Jay decides they can't move Maria. They can't take her to the hospital, so he runs off. And like it's like one panel he's running off, the next panel he's running back, and he is grabbing doctors from the hospital and bringing them to Maria for the delivery. And I just love those moments because Jay's, you know, first of all, he's getting it done, right? And then the next is you stop for a second as a reader and you go, are those even doctors that know how to deliver babies? You know, like, you know, what if they're podiatrists or something, you know? Like, and also the doctors don't seem freaked out at all. I mean, Jay's in the middle of a conversation. So clearly this all happens, boom, boom, boom. So Jay's bringing them and they're immediately like, okay, you know, start your breathing. You're going to be okay, dear, all that kind of thing. So I got to think that life in Keystone City has got to suck for doctors because you're just being whisked around every day and you're just like, all right, I'm going to roll with it.
Well, you know, who knows what Jay was able to impart to them, you know, or if we went there at super speed, maybe he was able to go and find, you know, the right doctors, you know, he could, at super speed, find out who the doctors are and I need to go grab real quick. I don't know.
It happens in the middle of a sentence, though. He's like, you know, if we bring the doctors, and then he's grabbed two doctors to her.
Well, that's how flashes work. Flashes can exist within like the microseconds of a sentence and, right, you know, get a whole lot done.
But he didn't have time to explain to the doctors what he was doing to them. He just grabbed them and ran.
You're right. But, you know, you go with it. What I love about this moment, though, is that it is in a very subtle way, it's showing that Jay still has something to offer. Wally is saying, oh, this poor girl's in labor, we've got to get her to a hospital, and Jay's like, at super speed, no, she's about to give birth, she's better off where she is in case we do anything with, like, moving her super speed might affect the baby, you know. And so he says it's better for us to bring the doctors to her.
Yeah.
You know, and so I was like, okay, it's cool that Jay was the one to show that because it shows his level of experience. It shows that he isn't just the old geezer who is just trying to hang on, you know, to a past hero life that he's no longer up for. No, he still has something to offer. You know, he's still vital and has some wisdom to impart. You know, and maybe I'm reading more into it than that, but I that's what I look at when I say, no, you know, he's actually teaching Wally something there.
That's fair. And at the end, Wally acknowledges that Jay talked her through the delivery. So, like, mm-hmm. that's another, you know, I don't know, father figure kind of thing to do. He talked mm-hmm. to this poor woman who, you know, her husband, God knows where he was. You know, she didn't know. He could be dead. He could be in jail, whatever. And Jay stayed there and, you know, talked her through it, which is lovely.
Yeah. I think it shows Jay's age, you know, whereas Wally is very impulsive, which is demonstrated at the beginning of the story, Jay knows how to use his speed wisely and also knows when not to use his speed. And so, you know, again, it just goes back to Jay being this essential advisor figure to Wally. So it works well.
Yeah. So we got to talk about the ending, right?
Yes, I guess we do.
So it's this lovely Christmas setting. Wally opens the baseball glove. Him and Linda have a touching moment. The doorbell rings. And there's even a funny line where the doorbell rings because they're like, hey, it's really late at night. You know, Wally, did Santa decide to come down, ring the doorbell instead of the chimney? Are you expecting the man in red? Which is very clever. And he opens the door, of course, and it's Barry Allen, who is like leaning on the doorway in like a ta-da kind of way. It's very strange. But it was... I mean, massive. I mean, just the DC landscape shook when this issue hit. I mean, this was a big deal. I think we all knew it was coming because of the solicitations. At least I, you know, in the comic shop I was working at, like, we had the solicitations for the next issue. So we knew that it was a return of Barry Allen. But I mean, that was huge, man.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I actually didn't know when I first got this off the shelf that Barry was coming. Because I didn't have a comic book shop near me. And I was buying my comics at a local, like a convenience store that still carried comics, or there was a bookstore that had a comic book section. Mm-hmm. So there was never any kind of special solicitations and I always seemed to buy the comics that didn't have the solicitations for upcoming stuff.
Okay.
I always seemed to be missing those. Because remember back in the day, DC used to have like the direct currents where they used to show like whatever. But for some reason, I was always like, there was one week I wouldn't buy and I wouldn't get whatever was going on for that week. But anyway, but I was shocked. And as a young reader, I was excited by the prospect of Barry Allen being back, or what this mystery about him being back would mean, and like what's going on there. But now, and this is probably an unpopular opinion, because this story is a classic Barry Allen story, and it is one of my favorite stories. The Return of Barry Allen, I think, is a wonderful story that, you know, brings together a lot of different elements and history aspects of the history of Flash. And I, like I said, as a young reader, I was very excited about this. But reading this now as an adult who enjoys more character-driven stories, and this being such a character-driven story from the get-go, I really wish they had ended the story with the kiss between Linda and Walt.
Oh, okay. You know? Sure. Yeah.
Because I'm like, that would have been a nice bookend. These guys have a great future ahead of them. And then find some way to do, like, just the punctuation at the end. It just, I get it. And it works, especially if you were a young reader at the time. But it just feels like, oh gosh, these people don't even get a chance to breathe before the next catastrophe comes up. I mean, can't they just have a Christmas without your dead uncle showing up?
Oh my gosh.
What I mean?
To be fair, the last couple of issues are, they do have a little banner hanging off of this says epilogue. Mm. So, I mean, it is kind of its way of telling you the story's over now, but we've got one more thing to share. So at least, you know, you did kind of get a moment where it was right at the birth, that's actually where it ends. Where Joey and Maria reunite is where technically it ends, and then you get the epilogue, which is the tease for the upcoming story. But I hear what you're saying.
Well, there's a tease, and then there's like, I'm going to set off this nuclear bomb in this quiet little character-driven story you've been writing with the return of a character that we all thought was dead. You know, it worked at the time, and I was excited at the time. I specifically remember getting this book off the shelves and reading it and having my mind blown that it at least looked like Barry Allen was back. Just nowadays, now as an adult, I'm like, okay.
I see what you're saying. I mean, you can say that we still love the return of Barry Allen storyline, and we love this issue. You just wish they were separate, and I get it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It makes sense. Well, all right. So, speaking of moments, now this is the moment where we're going to nominate the All-Star Award. This is where we nominate our favorite moment from the issue, whether it's like a story beat or something in the yard, something that's made us laugh, whatever. Both Steve and myself are going to pick one moment each to spotlight, and those each will both earn an All-Star Award. Steve, you're the guest, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So why don't you pick your moment?
Well, it's a moment that you actually brought up. I was a moment that I was kind of avoiding because I didn't want to come right out and say it, but you brought it up. And we already talked about it a little bit. It was the moment where Jay Garrick decides to go get the doctors and bring them to Wally and to Maria rather than them try to rush her off to the hospital. And I've already kind of said why I think that's such a great moment is because it showcases Jay so well. It's so subtle, and it without it being like overly done, as in Jay is the mentor figure and he still has a lot to offer, you know, it just very, very quickly and very elegantly shows Jay's experience, shows his ability to assess a situation and to be a valuable asset in an emergency situation like this. So that's just a moment that sticks out to me. It's a moment that I remember specifically from the first time I read it. So I figured, hey, this has to be a significant moment, at least from my perspective. So there you have it.
And that's a good
no
one.
Other correct answer for this one, Shag. That's the only correct answer.
Well, then I will share my incorrect answer, which is the page that we raved about right out of the gate, which is page 2, which is those six repeating panels of Jay peeling the potatoes and Wally being at first adorable, then a little irritating, and then get him the hell out of my house. It's Jay, Joan, and Wally again in that suburban setting, and it just makes me so happy. So I just love it. So that is my nomination. They're both great moments, and they're both Jay moments, which is nice too, considering the nature of this podcast. So that's fantastic. So congratulations to Jay running off and getting doctors and nurses, to Jay peeling potatoes. You have both won All-Star Awards. They're as tangible as our love for those moments. Please wear them with pride. So now we're going to do a little special feature. We did this earlier with Jose as well, where we are each going to pick another Christmas story, just to briefly mention that we love, something that people could enjoy. Why don't you go first, buddy?
All right. Well, the moment you told me that I needed to pick something, I knew exactly what I was going to pick.
All right.
And it's from the same era, actually, a similar era. It's Christmas with the Superheroes number 2 from 1989. It's an issue that has one banging story after another. There's a Superman story. There's a great Batman-ish story that with a Robin, an actual Robin that gets into the Batcave and has to fight off a bat that's trying to hurt it. And it's a very resilient, the story about resilience of hope and love. It's a really beautiful little story. And there's also that classic Enemy Ace story that's written and penciled by John Byrne with a finished art by Andy Kubert. You know, that's cueing Rob Kelly somewhere saying he went to the Kubert school somewhere. And that's a story that's told with no words as well. That's a very good use of just the images to convey the story without any kind of word balloons or what have you. But the story that stands out to me, and I think most people are going to know exactly what I'm talking about, is the Dead Man's story in that issue.
Mm.
It's written by Alan. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, it's a little bit infamous. So yeah.
It's written by Alan Brennert and penciled by the great Dick Giordano. The story is notable, of course, for the cameo from a woman who is heavily resembling a pre-crisis Supergirl. She even says her name is Kara. She gives Dead Man a pep talk about doing good for the sake of doing good, even if no one remembers who you are. And for me, I remember reading that as a kid because I was at that point, you know, still like navigating the post-crisis DC universe. I had very vivid memories of reading Crisis number 7. So it was a gut punch. Like, oh my God, they are in this very, in a not so subtle way, saying, oh my gosh, Kara Zor-El is still out there. It's either her ghost or she's in an existence now where she can see Dead Man. And it was, I didn't get really what they were doing at the time, but it was more of a, you know, I get, looking back on it now, I see it as like the love letter to the character that it was mm-hmm. meant to be. And also, you know, kind of like I don't know if there was any kind of like FU meant towards the DC editorial for deciding to kill off Supergirl. But it felt like somebody was saying, we love this character and we don't want to forget her. And it was told through a very, you know, a touching story with Dead Man trying, dealing with his own angst and his own feeling like people don't know I even exist because they can't see me, you know, and if I'm going to experience anything, I have to steal experiences from people by possessing their bodies, you know. And so it's one of those stories that stuck with me as a kid from having read it for the first time. And it's what immediately came to mind the moment that you asked me to pick a story. So there you have it.
That's a great one. That's a good one. Mm-hmm. And
has anyone else picked it from your Christmas episodes?
No, not for these Christmas episodes. I mean, it certainly comes up in a lot of Christmas discussions, but no, not for these Christmas episodes. So that's a great pick, and a very infamous story, and all kinds of, like, you know, the havoc it caused at DC when they published that story is legendary, at least the rumors of it. I picked a fun little story. It's not anything heart-wrenching or anything like that, but it's a sweet little story. It's DCU Holiday Bash from December 1996. I loved these DCU Holiday Bash books in the 90s. I just adored them. Now, if you go looking for it, it's cover dated 97, but that's the way those things, but it actually came out in 96. The story is called Present Tense, and I was kind of led to it because it's a Wally story, so I thought this kind of worked well with what we're discussing here. Written by Brian Augustin and Mark Waid. Penciler is Paul Ryan and inker is Dick Giordano. And it's just a silly little story about Wally trying to find the right Christmas gift for his girlfriend Linda. Now, he remembers that she told him exactly what she wanted, but in the story, he realized he wasn't listening to her, and he can't remember. So now it's moments before their Christmas party, and Wally's out of time. So he races to stores, you know, arriving moments before they close, and on instinct, like any idiot guy, buys a terrible gift in a panic, and he realizes it's a terrible gift, so he just gets rid of it. So then he races to the next time zone, because, you know, all the stores are closing, to try and find a store that's still open in that time zone. And again, he buys another terrible gift, and it goes over. Then he just keeps going. He just just keeps going to later time zones to the point where he finally goes to Hawaii and Hong Kong and all these things. And in the end, Wally finally remembers the gift Linda asked for. She's asked for no gift other than Wally to show that he truly loves Linda by listening to her. Really listening to her with all his heart, because it's hard to fight for his attention between alien invasions and supervillain battles. So she's thrilled, Wally remembers, and we end with a very loving Christmas moment. And there's a lot of jokes throughout about really ugly sweaters and stuff like that. So it's just a cute, fun little 8-page story. And I just thought, it, you know, it'd be fitting since we're talking about Wally.
Yeah, I remember that story. I enjoyed it at the time. And if you're a young guy who ever had a girlfriend that you had to buy a gift for and you had no clue what, I mean, you know, obviously you're not jumping around through timelines like Wally, but I don't know many men who haven't had the experience of like, oh crap, I've got to get my girlfriend and my wife something. What am I going to do? And just go from store to store or figure something out, you know?
And usually you talk yourself into buying a garbage gift because you're like, in your head, You've rationalized why it's the right gift. And then after a while, you take a moment and you step back and you're like, oh, what have I done?
Exactly. Exactly. So it's very relatable in that aspect. So yeah, good choice. I like that one.
All right. Well, Steve, I need to ask a favor.
Yeah, what's that?
Would you mind hanging out here for a few minutes? Because I need to go read the listener feedback. And something seems off with Barry Allen's sudden return to life, especially since Geoff Johns is not at this Christmas party.
Mm. Yeah, I'm going to spike his eggnog with strychnine because he's better off dead anyway.
Right there with you, buddy. Now, don't worry, Steve. We will bring you back to the end of the show. But after this podcast promo break, I'm going to read your listener feedback in a segment called The Society Pages.
Coming soon, JLA Stories and Friends, a new podcast in which I, Steve Givens, sit down with some close personal friends to discuss a variety of different kinds of stories, all either featuring or closely related to the greatest superhero team ever, the Justice League of America. Be on the lookout for JLA Stories and Friends wherever you get your podcasts.
The Society Pages. The Society Pages is the segment of the show where we cover your feedback from the previous episodes. Now remember, folks, you can find us on social media as JSA Presents, or more importantly, leave your comments on our website, because as I always say, it's about building a community of online JSA fans around the show. Now to start us off, we're going to read a new iTunes or Apple Podcast review, and if you haven't left an iTunes or Apple Podcast review, please consider it. It really helps to raise the profile of the show and attract new listeners. You can look for Justice Society Presents and leave your review there. Now if you're outside the United States, just let me know that you left a review, otherwise I won't see it unless I filter to your specific country. And as a thank you, I'll read your entire iTunes or Apple Podcast review on the air. So here we go. Here's one from Comic Foil. It says, great for long or short drives. It says, Shag is about a professional host as you can while still being incredibly fun to listen to. And the selection of different co-hosts he lands for each episode is always solid, bringing their own enthusiasm and knowledge about comics' first superhero team. If you're new to the Justice Society or even an old vet, you'll find plenty to enjoy here. Aw, well, thank you, Comic Foil. That was very kind of you. Again, folks, please look on iTunes or Apple Podcasts for Justice Society Presents. Now, I have pulled together your feedback from the past two episodes because I did not read your feedback last time. So we're covering two episodes worth of feedback. I collected it all from our website and social media. I put it in a Google Doc that is 22 pages long. You people are amazing, and I love your participation. Obviously, I can't read every word or this will be a four-hour podcast. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to acknowledge every single person who left a comment on the website, and I'm going to read a portion of their comments. So, first up, we're going to be covering the previous episode covering Justice Society of America number 10 with my guest, Tim Price. First up is Steve Dill, who says, another great episode. And for Charles McNider and his assistant having a relationship outside of work, it's very possible. Steve goes on to say, this JSA series is my favorite by far. Sadly canceled way too early, was just getting going and had huge potential. I need 10 more issues at least. This series, there are so many things like the character development, shared love of JSA members that they have for each other, and the JSA becoming real people to me by the normal way they are portrayed reacting to life situations. These are just a few of the many details in my mind to like. And then Steve says how enjoyable would have been to have Power Girl stop by to check on the old guys in the ensuing and banter with Wildcat, drawn by Mike Parabek. Steve, that's absolutely a missed opportunity. And you know, they did a JSA Justice League Europe crossover, and that would have had Power Girl and Wildcat together, and Parabek even drew some of those pages, but I don't believe there's any interaction like that, which is just disappointing. Then we heard from Rob McCarthy, author of the book The Star and the Space Princess and other stories. In that episode, we had posed the question, what were some people's favorite final issues? Well, Rob shares a few. Says Marvel 2-in-1 Annual number 2, the final Accept No Substitutes, Death of Warlock, is my favorite superhero story. Then they said The Joker number 9. Is it a good comic? No. It's quickly written, code-approved homage to the movie King of Comedy. And then question number 36, pretty perfect ending. And then the final issue of Jonah Hex before the New 52 era began. Thanks for the suggestions, Rob. Then we're from Brian Schufo, who says, I haven't read them in years, but the end of the Impact line seemed rushed. But I remember enjoying the end of The Comet. I have some vague memories of the story being turned up to 11, maybe to get the conclusion earlier than they intended. I would tell you how it ended, but it doesn't seem to be available on DC Infinite. And after Googling, quote, Comet Impact, has me curled up in a ball in the corner of my bedroom. that's never anything I'd want to look up, Brian. Absolutely. Then we heard from Super Captain. This is, first of all, Tim, I also love the comic Bone. I haven't read it all yet, but it's good to know that Smith kept up the high quality throughout the entire book. A recent favorite issue was Justice Society of America number 12. Not only was it the final issue of that volume of JSA, but it was also the end of the Geoff Johns era of the team that started back in the late 1990s. It's a fantastic tribute to Stargirl dedicated to Johns' late sister Courtney, who inspired the creation of the character. Then Super Captain says, looking forward to the coverage of the prior limited series and will be rereading along. That's fantastic, Super Captain. Can't wait for you to join us on the trip. Then we heard from Jeff R., who says, final issues, Zot number 36 was a perfect ending. You know, Jeff, I have got this giant collection of Zot sitting on my shelf that I've been meaning to read for like 5 years. I've never got around to it. I really need to do that. So maybe this is the kick in the butt to get it done. Jeff also says, I also picked Flash number 350. I wasn't following the trial closely, but I did pick it up. A fitting happy ending in the future, after which nothing bad ever happened to Barry or Iris. Then Jeff says, then into the slightly cheating realm, whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow, the Superman part at least should qualify. There was a new number one, and the numbering went to a different title. Jeff, whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow is a perfect example of a fantastic ending, without a doubt. That was very much a conclusion to the entire Bronze Age Superman. And finally, Jeff says, and thinking about title changes, well, the Legion has had a lot of final issues, several of them excellent, but the Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes number 258 was an ending and a turning point to remember. Then we heard from Dr. Ange from the Supergirl blog, Comic Box Commentary, and the Legion of Superbloggers. He also got into the final issue idea. Says the first one that came to mind was the 1990s Shade the Changing Man. In the end, Shade loves Kathy so much that he tries to rewrite time to spare her so much of the tragedy that entered her life. But that means that they would have never met, plummeting him into despair. The final panels are him finally forcing himself to meet her, standing at her doorway in the pouring rain. She invites him in. It was the perfect ending to that weird comic, a comic I truly love. Hey, Ange, I'm right there with you. I love Shade the Changing Man. In fact, I just got at the Baltimore Comic Con, I got Mark Buckingham to do the most amazing, beautiful sketch of Shade the Changing Man that I will treasure for the rest of my life. It's got to be one of the most impressive sketches I've ever seen. So love that book. Then Dr. Ainge says, the next one I thought of was the Baxter series Legion of Superheroes. Yes, 5YL would be out there soon, but Paul Levitt's wrapping up his incredible run with the team, winning the Magic Wars, but looking upon an uncertain future, still ready to do what was needed, was a wonderful swan song. And then he says, I do think Mike Parabek's art and his time being cut short has made this far more cherished than it would have been without him on the book. And that was a question we posed. You know, if we hadn't lost Mike Parabek, and if the series hadn't been so short, would we look back on the series as fondly? And yeah, Dr. Ainge thinks that maybe that does play a role, and he's probably right. Then we heard from Chris Franklin from the Firewater Podcast Network. He has a Mr. and Mrs. Superman show right here on JSA Presents. He also has the JLU cast and much more. Chris says, great wrap-up for this JSA ongoing series, Shag and Tim. Like I said previously, for several years, I was unaware the 10th issue actually came out. I was picking up some comics at comic shops, but I was still doing most of my purchasing from the same newsstand I had since early childhood. So it was a result of the dreaded newsstand trap you mentioned early in the episode. I did eventually see the comic at a show and picked it up. Then as far as final issues, issues, he says, Starman number 80 is also my favorite final issue of any series I've read. Another strong one is Brave and the Bold number 200, with its non-team-up but parallel Earth 1, Earth 2 Batman stories. And then, addressing that question we posed, Chris says, I don't think this series would be as well-remembered without the Parabek art. The stories were good, but I think the art and Parabek's unfortunately short life and career really made this a standout. We just didn't get enough from him, so we'll cherish every page he drew. Yeah, I think you're right. And he says, looking forward to where the show goes from here. Oh, well, thank you. We are really looking forward to diving into that 8-issue miniseries, the JSA in the 90s. I cannot wait. They heard from Sean Ross from the Fire and Water Podcast Network. He has shows such as Peacebound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast. Sean says, great episodes, guys. I'm sad to see the series end, but I'm excited to move closer to the amazing 1999 series. And then Sean says, favorite final issues? Starman was a great choice. I would also go with Why the Last Man, which has a gut punch moment that wraps the story up nicely. I also love the last issue of Shade the Changing Man. The book had really petered out at that point, but the last issue opens the door on the Shade and Kathy romance again, which had been the heart of the best years of the series. On the flip side, the final issue of Ex Machina made me so angry that I refused to ever read that book again, even though I really enjoyed much of it. Wow, Sean, that, pretty strong words. Okay, I'll trust you on that one. They heard from Dick, who says, no one seems to remember this one at all, but one of my favorite final issues was Dynamo Joe number 15 from First Comics, 1980s mecha-centric military sci-fi story that bounced around as a backup or anthology feature in a few other books before getting its own title, which was due for 3 issues and wound up getting 15 instead. The last issue wrapped up the overarching conflict that had been central to everything in an unexpected but satisfying way that left things open for a revival or continuation. That never happened, but the characters we'd been following got a solid but believable happily ever afters. And that left them in good spots without definitively ending their stories either. Thanks for the suggestion, Dick. I remember that book being on the stands, but I never read it. Interesting. They were from Mark Baker Wright from Black Rock's Toy Box and Not Your Father's Autobot podcast. Mark says, when I think about final issues of favored series, I especially gravitate to the ones I was there for as they happened. First and foremost, I think of the final issue of the Marvel Transformers series, number 80 in 1991. That was definitely one of those where they learned of the cancellation and had to quickly wrap things up. Now, Mark shares a lot of information here, so I'm just going to cherry pick some of his comments. He says, I'm not so convinced that they wrapped it up particularly cleanly, but it was a closure nonetheless. The official attempt to pick up the original series decades later with Regeneration 1 in 2012 was decidedly unsatisfying. Sometimes even a rushed ending is better left where it is. That's a good point, Mark. We've all seen lots of reunion, whether they be TV specials or comics or whatever, that don't hold up to the original. Then Mark says, I won't talk too much about the ending of Firestorm with number 100 in 1990, since Shag has already done so. And folks, actually, if you don't know at home, I did a podcast for many, 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 many years called Aquaman and Firestorm, the Fire and Water Podcast, which is what birthed our entire network. So I have talked about Aquaman and Firestorm quite a bit. So anyway, back to it. Mark's talking about Firestorm number 100 here. He says, I will note that it was at least more along the lines of a planned ending. And that series may have been low on sales, but it ended as much because the creative team was ready to move on as it was for other reasons. So they seem to have had time to give the series the closure they wanted to. Yeah, Mark, absolutely. The way they built a Firestorm number 100 was fantastic. I'm a big fan of the Elemental run. A lot of people aren't, but I am, and I thought that was a great conclusion. Now, Mark goes on to say, more of a mix of the timing wasn't quite what the creators wanted, but the ending was nonetheless what had been intended for a long time, and they were given about a year to draw all the threads to a closure, was the end of IDW's first Transformers continuity, and especially the saga of the Lost Light. It goes on to say the threads of that conclusion were seeded years beforehand, and speaking only for myself, I found it satisfying. Yeah, well, that's good. It's always nice when a series you enjoy goes out the way, leaving you feeling good about it. Then we're from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. He says, another great episode. And he poses a question. He says, what do you think Jake Garrick's favorite radio show and later TV show would have been? I have no guess here, Bucky, but thankfully some folks chimed in. Mark Baker Wright says, not sure how one would determine this, and was Jay's personality even defined enough in the Golden Age to determine more than a generic idea? But I'm going to guess as things like the Blue Beetle radio show or The Avenger. Then James Williams chimes in, says, I think Jay and Joan would listen to the radio together. Being married to a superhero, I can't see Joan wanting to listen to a superhero radio show. Ditto for crime. I see them listening to a comedy together, and I've come up with 3 choices. Amos and Andy was the most popular radio show until the early 1940s, and in the 1930s, it was probably the most popular program ever broadcast. Nothing since the prime years of Amos and Andy have been as popular. Then James suggests Jack Benny was arguably the best comedy ever done, and then he says Fibber McGee and Molly was on for over 2 decades. It featured a married couple who were married in real life that had more of a hometown feeling to it than Jack Benny, so Fibber McGee and Molly Valley would be my guess. Great suggestions, James, and thank you for bringing the historical knowledge on radio shows. Now, James Williams continues with his own comment. He says, one Christmas in the early 1970s, I got a box full of DC comic books from the early 1960s. One of the issues included was the last issue of the Silver Age version of the Doom Patrol. I'd never even heard of the Doom Patrol, so this was my first exposure to them, and I've been a fan ever since. The end of that issue is so different than any other final issue that I can think of, so it gets my vote for the best final issue. I'm intentionally being vague because I don't want to spoil the ending for anyone who hasn't read it. James, that's very kind of you. I won't spoil it either. I think most people probably are aware of it simply because Who's Who talked about it ad nauseum, and then every appearance of the Doom Patrol in the 1980s talked about it ad nauseum. But yeah, I mean, what an ending. Wow! So, good suggestion, James. Then we heard from Brett Miller. It says, this month's question hit remarkably hard, being that I listened on the day of my 90-year-old uncle passing away. At our ages, older heroes, like older people in general, are getting harder to find. That means that we in our 50s are the older people that younger generations are supposed to be looking up to. It's our job to give them something worth idolizing. Thanks for giving something to think about. Great show as usual. Well, thank you, Brett. I appreciate the kind words, and I'm very sorry for your loss. I can certainly empathize. This year has... 2025 was a real kick. I lost my stepmother, who was 80. I lost a beloved uncle, who was about that age as well. My father had to have some very serious surgery at his age of 85. My mother-in-law, who's 82, just was injured within the last week very severely. So, watching the older generation suffer is very difficult. And you're right, we are becoming the next older generation, and we do need to think about that and what we're leaving behind for the people after us. So thank you, Brett. And again, I'm sorry for your loss. Okay. On to happier things. Let's go. So we heard from John Stibe. John says, to answer Tim's question about Mercury on the hood of the car, Justice League of America number 135 features Mercury from the Shazam pantheon standing on the hood of the Earth 2 Batman's Batmobile, and is indeed flies into space and lands on Earth S, I think. This is one of my early JLA-JSA crossovers and a favorite of mine, as it introduced me to the whole another world of superheroes with the Fawcett characters. I mean, Mr. Scarlet and Pinky, Spy Smasher, Ibis the Invincible, Bullet Man and Bullet Girl. I love these comics. Thank you for the info. All right, then we're here from Alan Williams from the Monsters from the Id and Watch This Space podcast. It says, awesome episode as usual. But Shag, Shiera was never Hawk Woman, except in her first appearance in the costume way back in Flash Comics. She was always Hawk Girl. You know, Alan, I know that innately, but I always screw it up because I have a hard time calling a 70-year-old woman Hawk Girl. But you're right. Thank you for pointing that out. Then I guess in the episode, I referred to Al Pratt as Alan Pratt. I'm not sure where that came from. I know that his name is Albert. So anyway, Alan pointed that out. Thank you. I don't know why I messed that up. And then as for the final issues, maybe it's a cheat, but Secret Origins number 50, especially the origin of Black Canary 1 and 2 post-crisis. Alan Bretter did a wonderful job of just completely ignoring all pre-crisis shenanigans. Alan, you're absolutely right. The Black Canary origin in Secret Origins number 50 is absolutely fantastic. Really did a great job and cleaned her history up so good. And then another one Alan suggested, Supergirl volume number 4, number 80, where Peter David wraps up the story of Linda Danvers as Supergirl after the wild ride through the series. It's a bit rushed, but it still wraps up everything nicely and gives us an excellent reason for Linda to retire. And one more, which may seem strange, but Earth 2 Society number 22, one of the few things I thought got off to a good start in the New 52 was James Robinson's new version of Earth 2. It was one of the times I've been really pleased with James Robinson's writing. After Robinson left, the concept of Earth 2 floundered terribly for a long time, but by the end of the Earth 2 Society, Dan Abnett rescued the whole idea and brought the series to what I felt was a successful conclusion without retelling a bunch of Golden Age stories. That's fantastic to hear, Alan. I tried the Earth 2 series in the New 52. It didn't do a lot for me, but I will say, Dan Abnett, okay, you got my attention there, so maybe I need to check these out. They were from Joe LaWallen, who says, thanks for this great series of podcasts on a true favorite run of my favorite DC team. Love the issues back in the 90s and reread them for the podcast. Older heroes done really well. Beautiful art. Aw, well, thank you for reading along, Joe. I appreciate that. And then he suggests final issue has to be ElfQuest number 20, The Original Quest Ends. Every issue of the original one was an event, but it came out quarterly. Even though there would have been many issues of ElfQuest since then, nothing's ever topped Wendy Pini's masterpiece. Good suggestion, ElfQuest. Man, ElfQuest is... I've never been an ElfQuest guy, but the number of people I know that think ElfQuest is fantastic is huge. And when I worked at the comic shop, I mean, that series was beloved. So, good suggestion. Then we heard from Martin Gray from the Too Dangerous for Girl blog. Nice work, Shag and Tim. He did a great job putting this period of the JSA to bed. It's such a shame they never had an epic battle with a classic foe. Ultra Humanite might qualify if he had not been redesigned into silliness. Oh, Martin. I don't think that redesign of Ultra Humanite was that bad. Anyway, Martin goes on and says, I still hate Our Man's yellow mask and Starman's green cowl. Don't mess with the classics. See also Hawkman's new vest. Just draw him as a hot daddy and don't worry about his supposed human age. Oh, Martin. Oh, my gosh. Just accept change, buddy. Bring it into your heart. I know your heart's full of joy. So bring that into your heart, buddy. And then he gives us some history. I had mentioned on the cover, the word the was taken straight from the Silver Age Flash logo. And he says, yes, the on the cover is certainly straight off the Silver and Bronze Age Flash, but it was also on many a house ad from the fabled DC designer Ira Schnapp, who designed that Flash logo. Look at that! Dropping the knowledge bomb. Thank you, Martin. And he says, a great final issue was also the New 52 Stormwatch. The likes of Jim Starlin and Peter Milligan had proven unable to make that book sing, but writer Sterling Gates and artist Jeremy Roberts came in for number 30 and smashed it, and it's on the DC app. Thank you for the suggestion, Martin. Then we're from Siskoid from the Fire & Water Podcast Network. He does the Let's Roll podcast, Who's Editing and More. He says they could have at least taken the series to 12 issues. Am I right? Yes, Siskoid, you are correct. Then we're from Comic Foil, who says, we were robbed by not having Starman on this cover. Big shout out thanks to Shag and each of his cohorts. These 10 episodes helped make a lot of travel for work this week much more bearable. Enjoyable even. Just about back home now, where I'll pull all these issues out and reread them over the weekend. Then next week, digging to all the Spotlight episodes I keep hearing mentioned. Justice Society Presents is the podcast that keeps on giving. Well, I hope you're enjoying them, Comic Foil. Then we're from Bradley Glenn, who says, here are three final issues that resonate with me. Marvel Transformers number 80 from 1991. First of all, Transformers was my favorite toy and cartoon franchise as a kid, and this series was my gateway into comics. When it suddenly wrapped up, it felt like a piece of my childhood was forever closing. Little did we know Transformers would eventually come back and basically never leave. That's a good point. They've really been around nonstop, haven't they? Then Bradley mentions Rebels number 17 from 1996. Starting with the acronym Legion title, I follow the stories of the various team members, if you can really call them a team. Vril Dox was the leader you love to hate, and the ending with his and Stealth's tyrant son Liril Dox is poignant. And then finally, Hitman number 60 from 2001. Garth Ennis and John McCrae make you care about the hilariously violent adventures of Tommy, Nat, and the rest of the guys at Noonan's Bar. Somehow, it's part of the main DC continuity. It's definitely a finale for the main characters. Well, thank you for the suggestions, Bradley. I've heard nothing but amazing things about Hitman, and I've never read it. Then we heard from someone named Jose Rivera. I've never heard of this guy. He says, here we are at the final issue of this run. I can't help but wonder what would have gotten if the series had continued. I know some say it would have been like the late 1990s JSA series, but when you think about it, that series was addressing what happened to the Justice Society in comics shortly after the series wrapped up, like characters being killed by Extant and Eclipso, or the legacy characters that came out, like Mr. Terrific. I would like to think we would have gotten something with Predegaton and a Justice League team-up of some kind. That's a great point, Jose. And then Tim Price chimes in from the Outcasters, Batman and the Outsiders podcast, which will very soon become Outcasters Under Siege in 2026. Tim says, that's a good point. What do I think would have happened next? I'm really bad at that, but there were seeds planted about Vandal Savage, the current JLA, McKnighter's medical partner, Kiku, and Jesse. So maybe more about T-Bolt's home, Jesse's parents and becoming her own hero rather than Wally's supporting character, the Hourmen becoming a hero team, and more obscure Golden Age villains. Without a doubt, the path could have been very different. Good thoughts for what could have happened, Tim. And I'll throw in there, I think we would have got Liberty Bell back in action as well. Tim continues saying, showing that I'm not that smart as usual, I thought of another notable final issue by Flamehead, of course meeting Ghost Rider number 81, where Johnny Blaze was cured of the curse at the time. Good suggestion. Then we're from Dave Comco from the website called New Earth 2. Dave says, another great episode, guys. This series definitely feels like it came to an end too quickly. I would have loved to see where it would have taken the story if it had been allowed to continue. I'm also bummed we haven't seen Kiku since this series. While I love Jakeem Thunder, I wish DC had given a little more time to other characters carried on Johnny's legacy, like Kiku, Willpower, Peachy Pet, and Shaco. And as for great final issues, I'll agree that Spectre and Starman both ended strong. It's rare to find a satisfying last issue for a series that didn't have a consistent creative team. Even books that do have one don't always stick the landing. Take JSA from 1999, for example. Jeff Johns wrote the whole series from the start, uncredited, through issue 81, aside from Keith Champagne's excellent four-issue arc. Then Paul Levitz wrapped up the book with a six-issue Gentleman Ghost story that felt more suited to JSA Classified. Issue 81 should have been the finale. The Stargirl-focused issue provided real closure for the series, and with Dale Eaglesham on art, it served as a great teaser for John's follow-up Justice Society of America series. In fact, each of John's final Justice Society issues seems to spotlight Stargirl and bring things to a satisfying close, whether or not the series continue without him, which includes Justice Society of America from 2006, number 26, and Justice Society of America from 2022, number 12. I'm looking forward to more JSA in the 90s character spotlight episodes and the 1991 series. Awesome! Well, thank you so much, Dave, and I hope you enjoy what we've got to come. Then we're from Symbol Pending from the Power Girl blog called Symbol Pending. It says, to be on brand, one of my favorite last issues is the last issue of the All-Star JSA run, though because of the implosion, it was finishing off in Adventure Comics number 466. It says, cheating a little, like the show did, I also have a soft spot for the last issue of Steve Orlando's Supergirl run from 2016, issue number 19. A nice, quiet little story where Kara is just decent and accepting person around a non-binary person. Thanks for the suggestion, Symbol Pending. Then we heard from Simon Pierre Desmarais. It says, great episode as always. The JSA is my favorite super team, and this comic was the first JSA title I bought. Love this channel. I read along, and it feels like I'm with a comic book club. Keep up the good work. And P.S., I'm impressed how Shag pronounced my name. That was good. Thanks. Well, Simon Pierre, I am notoriously terrible at pronouncing names, so I can't promise I will get it right in the future. I will keep trying, though. Then we're from Jason R. Lady, author of the young adult humorous fantasy adventure novels Monster Problems, Super Problems, Time Problems, and The Pure Short Club. Jason says, not too many comic series finales stand out for me. A lot of them seem to be rushed or end the phrase where the series is truly limping to the finish line. A grievous one for me is the ending of the original Marvel Star Wars series with issue 107. I started collecting at issue 104, and the poor, naive fourth grader in me was dismayed it was canceled so abruptly. It did launch an epic multi-year back-issue hunt for me to put together the rest of the series, but the abrupt wrap-up of ongoing storylines like the Nagai Toph War and Lomaya's grudge against Luke was very disappointing. Yeah, Jason, I know the end of Star Wars comic hit a lot of people hard. No doubt about it. So, and hey, why not? I will plug my own other podcast, Marvel Star Wars From Empire to Jedi, where I'm covering a lot of those Marvel Star Wars comics. There we go. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to plug, Jason. And then Jason goes on to say, alas, the grim and gritty early 1990s comic book landscape didn't have room for a JSA ongoing. I don't think the choice of stories did any favors. The paperback art is wonderful, but definitely not in vogue at the time. Too bad. I think different timing and maybe it would have been had more traction. With the introduction of Jesse Quick and Kiku and the inclusion of Rick Tyler, it did plant a seed that Robinson and Johns would run with years later with a multi-generational team of heroes with older heroes mentoring younger ones. You know, Jason, I just want to chime in there for a second. I actually would give credit to probably Jerry Conway for bringing that idea into All-Star Comics number 58 when they introduced the Super Squad, because there you had an older JSA team, but they put in Power Girl, they put in Star-Spangled Kid, they put in Earth 2 Robin, who didn't stay around forever, but then later on, other writers introduced Huntress. So I actually would say the JSA had been doing the multi-generational thing for a while. And then Jason goes on to say, alas, Alex Ross ignored Kiku in Kingdom Come and created Joaquin Thunder, who I like, but DC writers' sometimes puzzling devotion to Kingdom Come stuff meant they were going to run with Joaquin as the legacy and put Kiku on the bench. Yeah, I think you're right there. And, you know, you made a good point, too, about Kingdom Come. I mean, I love Kingdom Come. I think it's fantastic. But the fact that so many writers keep chasing it almost implies that they didn't get the point of the series. The point of the series was to address how 1990s comics had gotten so grim dark, whereas it seems like everyone just wants to chase Kingdom Come, and like that's not what the point of the story was. All right, then got a long message from Scott Hilleman, quite a bit there, and he said he was just dropping a quick on JSA in the 90s podcast. He suggested some interview ideas. He suggested some discussion ideas about how people perceive characters. And then he says, I love these characters. I really do. But I'm beginning to wonder if it makes sense for them to be 100 years old superheroes running around. I don't mean they need to be killed off or thrown into limbo, but does it make sense to have them on the same Earth with everyone else in 2026 and beyond? I've always liked the familiar relationship between the older and younger heroes. Jay was Grandpa, Barry was Dad, Wally was the older brother, and Impulse was the teenager. That sense of family is strong in the DCU, and it worked being on the same Earth in the 1980s and 90s, maybe not so much in the 2000s, as great as those stories are. As people of the DCU may be wondering how Alan Scott is still running GBC, or Carter Hall is still doing archaeological digs. I mean, you pose a fair question, Scott. I mean, these characters had to be born in the 1920s, so therefore they're now over 100 years old. Does it make sense? I know they've been de-aged. It's one of those where it's hard for me to separate the fact of their age and my wish to continue enjoying reading their comics. So I don't know. It's a good question, Scott. Something to ponder. Then we heard from Dylan Crossman, who says, I've been slowly getting caught up with this quality podcast over a quality series. Oh, well, thank you, Dylan. And then Henry, Emperor of the Moon, was referencing the final page of JSA number 10, where we talked about that homage to All-Star Comics number 3's cover. This is definitely worthy of the All-Star Award. Great show this week. Classic coverage of the 1993 Justice Society of America number 10. Read before the show and realized I must have read it back in the 1990s. Well, thank you, Henry. I appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed. All right, now we're going to cover the feedback from the previous episode where we talked about the Mayfair Games role-playing source book, The World at War, with my guest Siskoid. Hal gave us a lot of great information, who says, good show. I was able to follow along with my copy. Here are a few thoughts that I had as you went along. Now, again, Hal shared a lot, so I'm just cherry-picking some things. He says, Roy Thomas originally wanted to use the quality heroine Wildfire for the All-Stars, but DC vetoed it. Editorial was worried it would become confused, but since there was already a Wildfire in the Legion. That's how Firebrand came about. How interesting, Hal. I had no idea. And then he says, I don't know if Roy Thomas was aware of the spicy culture pulp imprint that Harry Donenfeld, the publisher of DC for most of the Golden Age and Silver Age, also published in the 1950s. They had several characters who could quite easily have been analogs for the erased characters rather than the young All-Stars. Jim Anthony was the super detective, who was the Superman analog. Olga, the girl with X-ray eyes, could quite easily substitute for Wonder Woman. And Nick Turner, Hollywood detective, for Batman. I've never heard of this imprint by Harry Donenfeld. That sounds interesting, Hal. I'm going to assume Roy Thomas did, just because he's such a historian, but that's interesting. Hal mentions Winston Churchill should have been the one to write the commentary on the Blackhawks, since they were originally based in England and worked closely with the British in the early days of the war. That's a great catch, Hal. And he says, the reason you can't find a listing for Flower in Easy Company is because he didn't exist. Marv Wolfman screwed up with the name. It should have been Farmer Boy, who was killed in Crisis. Wow! I didn't know that. Thank you so much, Hal. That blew my mind. And he says, there are at least two missing war concepts from the war heroes. The demolition team of Big Al, Little Al, and Charlie Cigar, known as the TNT Trio, and war correspondent Wayne Clifford, who appeared in Dateline Frontline series. Also left out was a group called Das Primate Patrol. They only appeared in one issue of Weird War before 1991, but come on, who doesn't love Nazi gorillas? Wow, Hal, thank you so much for the knowledge bomb. Chris Franklin chimes in again and says, great show, guys. I never got to use my original Mayfair DC box set much. Never got an actual game campaign off the ground, but I did love the source books. I had no idea this one existed until you brought it up a while back. This book sounds legitimately fun and seems like a great reference for the characters, which is what I come for. Glad to see the original Earth 2 Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, of course my beloved Earth 2 Robin, weren't forgotten. I knew you'd like that, Chris. Alan Williams chimed in again, says, love the show. I never got into DC Heroes RPG, although it was definitely around the time when I first started gaming in 1998. My first exposure was the Hero System. This episode reminded me of the time I created a group called the Sentinels of Liberty for the Champions Hero System game in a gaming minicom in graduate school around 1991 to 1992. I later played them as NPCs in the regular Champions campaign I was running at the time when my players traveled back in time. Their enemies were the Axis Powers. I'm loving the analogs to the JSA there, Alan. That's fantastic. Then we're from Bucky749 again. It says, I think if I played with the pre-made characters, here's who I would be. First, I'd be Johnny Thunder, because somebody's got to be the comedy guy. Second, Hour Man. Third, Wildcat. Now, if I played a soldier, I'd play Haunted Tank or Patches from the Creature Commandos, because Frankenstein is my favorite, and I'm not going to pass up a chance to play a World War II version. Or number three, G.I. Robot, the original version, so I'd have to have his human operator as well. Some pretty cool characters you picked there, Bucky. Then we're from Dustin Gibbons. Now, Dustin, I'm sorry. I said something on that episode, which apparently created a bit of a confusion, specifically about Golden Age Aquaman in regard to the Young All-Stars. I for anyone at home that didn't understand what I was talking about, again, I mentioned earlier, I used to do a podcast called Aquaman and Firestorm, the Fire and Water Podcast. And on there, me and my co-host Rob Kelly, we would talk about the Golden Age Aquaman quite frequently. And we had this ongoing banter, argument, joke, whatever you want to call it, about the Golden Age Aquaman, whether he existed sort of on Earth 2 or whether he was simply the same character as the Earth 1 Aquaman. It's a long story, running gag. Wasn't worth your time, Dustin, to have to chase that down, so I apologize. Now, Dustin did have questions about the Young All-Stars. He says, are we to assume that any story that featured Golden Age Superman, for example, still happened post-crisis, but it happened with Arn Monroe instead and so on and so forth? That's a question I've always had. Also, Fury was originally Diana and Steve's daughter on Earth 2, but then wasn't post-crisis and got a new origin, etc. So if Fury is now the new Wonder Woman substitute, up until it's established later that Diana's mother went back in time to be the Golden Age Wonder Woman, was the assumption for her to do all the stuff Golden Age Wonder Woman did? Okay, Dustin, a couple different things. For your first question, actually, Siskoid chimes in. He says, just what happened in the 1940s without Superman, Batman, and others varies according to the story. Roy Thomas did an issue of All-Star Squadron, for example, where the squadron fought Funny Face instead of Superman. It was a Superman solo story. So sometimes it's the young All-Stars, sometimes it's someone else, sometimes it never happened at all. So that's a very fair summation of how the young All-Stars work. Very good. Now, regarding Fury, I think there's a little bit of confusion here. So Fury in the young All-Stars was a newly created character by Roy Thomas. She was not the same Fury that was in Infinity Inc. In fact, this newly created Fury in the Golden Age was supposed to substitute for a lot of Wonder Woman adventures. Then she was also used to explain how the Infinity Inc. Fury, her new origin, meaning she was no longer the daughter of Wonder Woman Diana Prince, she was now the daughter of the Golden Age Fury. So that's where she fit into there. Hope you enjoyed that history lesson, Dustin. All right. Then we heard from Mark Baker Wright again about Liberty Bell. He says, my only knowledge of Libby Lawrence came from modern comics such as All-Star Squadron. In fact, I had wrongly assumed that Libby was from one of the companies that DC bought out in later decades until Diavolo Frank informed me that she was, in fact, a DC creation from her beginning. And I have since been able to track down and read perhaps a dozen or so of her Golden Age appearances. What surprised me in reading those was how little the ringing of the actual Liberty Bell, which was said to give her a boost of adrenaline to explain her superheroic feats, was surprised at how little it actually features in the stories. Most of the time, Libby simply happened to be on the scene when the Nazis were up to no good, changed into her Liberty Bell costume, and set to work stopping them. Obviously, writers found the limitation of ringing the actual Liberty Bell difficult to work around and found it easier to just either ignore it or hand wave it. Interesting, Mark. Like you, I assume Liberty Bell was just purchased from another company, and I thought the ringing of Liberty Bell happened all the time, so it's interesting to hear that it didn't actually happen that often in this Golden Age. Then we're from Dr. Ange again, who says, sounds like a super fun book. I love things like this. And then I didn't know who the White Lions were during the source book discussion. And he says, White Lions were the Black Hawk-inspired Nazi flight team in Howard Chaykin's miniseries. Ah, there we go. Thank you, Dr. Ange. Sean Ross chimed in again, says, truly fun episode, guys. World War II in the DC Universe is a high point for comics. I would love a new volume of All-Star Squadron by Mark Waid and Chris Samnee. Wow, there's an All-Star team. That would be great. He says, I especially love the conceit that the source book is narrated by the characters. It added a fun element to the information. Then Rob McCarthy chimes in again, says, I didn't know the young All-Stars were in this source book. Now I have to read it. I totally missed that. Well, there you go, Rob. The more you know. Then Robert Markham chimed in and says, all pictures of Sergeant Rock and Easy Company in the Mayfair materials are from page 1 of Sergeant Rock number 380, but Farmer Boy was long dead by then and had been statted with Canary's head. Then he says, Sergeant Rock and Jeb Stuart's Haunted Tank teamed up several times in comics. And actually, Robert, after we recorded that episode, I actually went back and read a whole bunch of Haunted Tank stories and actually came across one with Sergeant Rock. Then he says, back in the Who's Who podcast, Shag and Rob pondered how to pronounce Johnny Quick's speed formula. Here's the German government answered with 2X29YZ4A. They also mentioned experimenting extensively with it. Also, it appears Johnny deduced how to summon the Thunderbolt between Flash Comics number 19 and 20 in July and August 1941. Well, thank you for all that information, Robert. I really appreciate it. Brett Miller says, I've never been into RPGs, but this could change my mind. Captain Entropy says, love this discussion, and I love that there's so much real history. He also adds they should have included stats for Stalin and Churchill. And then he says, a hero on the home front campaign would have been a problem for me, I think. After 9/11, it was more than a year and a half before I could deploy to support combat ops directly. So I know from similar experience that not directly fighting the main body of the Axis, while many other people were doing, would drive me to distraction. So maybe we could use that in the game. Interesting point of view, Captain Entropy, and thank you for sharing that. Then we're from Diablo Frank from the World Spine Podcasting Network, including DC Secret Files and Origins Podcast. Frank says, I prefer the unused cover to The World at War, mostly because it offers Baron Blitzkrieg with a more prominent Robot Man All-Star Squadron. The actual cover is very cleverly incorporates the superheroes into a more overly World War II supplement, but it also favors the Cooper-esque Sergeant Rock to the superhero aspect that is too minimalized. Frank, I don't know. When it comes to Hitler on covers, I don't think you need to go full Hitler. Anyway, and he says, I used to hoard reference materials when I still held out hope that I might someday write for DC Comics. I didn't need stats for human GIs, but I don't remember a lot of the wartime superheroes turning up in the Who's Who Least Leaf editions, and probably caught the All-Star Squadron types when giving this a toss. Then Brett Young from the Firewater Podcast Network, who hosts a show called Fantastic Poor, or as the cool kids call it, The Poor. Brett says, I've never been a role-playing game guy, so half of what you said and were talking about, I didn't understand, but I still really enjoyed the conversation. Great job, Siskoid and Shag. Well, thank you, Brett. Appreciate that. Then we heard from Alistair, who says, I bought this book on Siskoid and Shag's recommendation in the early days of the Hero Point Points podcast, along with the second edition of DC Heroes and the Alice of the DC Universe, and love it. So many Golden Age characters. I've been running a DC Heroes game on and off since 2020 with player characters as members of the Secret Society as supervillains. One 8-week installment had them flung back to Earth 2 to the post-war 1940s, desperately trying to find a way home. Along the way, they met the Injustice Society, aliens, the Viking Commando, the Creature Commandos, and traveled to Dinosaur Island with Wildcat, Black Canary, and Johnny Cloud. We got a ton of stories out of that book. Thanks, Shag and Siskoid, for pointing me and my gaming group to a game that has given us hours and hours of fun. Alistair, wow. And as Siskoid says, you are living the dream, Alistair. Wow. Joey Hoffman said, just started listening to this on the way home from work. Can't wait to finish it. And then said, finished it yesterday. Lots of fun. I'm glad you enjoyed it, Joey. James Williams chimed in again, says, I love these Veterans Day episodes. Thanks for doing them. Peter Watson chimed in from the Earth 2 podcast, says, I literally just bought this from the States. None available in the UK. Because of you, Shag. Well, Peter, I have no doubt you're going to love it. So you're welcome. Then Stephen E. Shen, the role-playing game designer extraordinaire, says, I'm catching up on other great podcasts like JSA Presents and Story and Game and Long Live the Legion that I've fallen behind on. Lots to listen to and not a lot of time. Well, Stephen, I hope you got a chance to catch up and I hope you're enjoying them. Then Comics Foil says, I'm not a gamer, but I own quite a few West End Game Star Wars books because I enjoy the info dump on characters, battles, and the history of the galaxy far, far away. Listening to this podcast, this book sounds like the exact same thing, but full of content on the Golden Age superheroes and soldiers. A gem. This one's great. And I'm also a fan of the West End Game Star Wars book. So I know if you like those, I think you'll enjoy this Comic Foil. So that wraps up the comments there. But I do want to give a quick shout out to the new Earth 2 website. Dave has been kind enough to announce our latest episodes over there. So thank you, Dave. I really appreciate that. All right. This is the part of the show where we thank everyone who shared our show on their social media timelines. We're talking about Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, Twitter or X, and Threads. Yes, as I always say, this is a long list of names. However, these folks show their support and help promote the show. So it's important to me that we recognize these individuals. This is the only time we're going to mention Clinton Robinson on this episode, but you know what? He is part of our community. So in this time out, we've got over 100 people who helped promote the last two episodes of the show. So thank you so much. Now you could be on this list next episode. Just it's very easy by sharing or retweeting or whatever it's called. Again, on Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, extra Twitter or Threads. Our thanks go out to A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast. Al Girding, Al Williams, Alan Boyce Jr., Andre Freitas, Andre R., the Redheaded Fanboy, Artsy Chef, Barry Reese's Infinity Ink Tumblr, Benjamin Hall, Between the Pages Blog, Bill Beer and the Batpod, Billy D., Black Vulcan 69, Brad Dade, Brian Schufo, Chris A. Field, Chris Franklin, Chris Helgerson, Chris Leiden, Chris Mort, Chris Retz, Cindy Womack, Clinton Robinson and Coffee and Comics, Codex Omniversa, Collateral Cinema, Comic Foil, Comics Out of Context, Craig McD., D. Kennedy at Detective 38, Dan Dougherty, Dave Tomko and the New Earth 2, Dave's Comics Heroes Blog, David A.'s Gutierrez, DC Retro Cabal, Derek Crabb, Diablo Frank, Doug Adamson, Dr. Ange, Dr. Pop Culture USA, Dr. Jennifer Swartz Levine, Earth 2 Podcast, Ed Moore and his Teal Productions, Extremely Uncanny, Philby, Gaming News, Gentleman Joey, Grumpy Old John, Gus Casals, Henry, Emperor of the Moon, Joe Tonello, John Stibe, J.P. Roca, Julia Rowell, Justice Trek, Justin Steiner, Keen Comics, Keechee Baker, Kirk Spencer, Liz Ann Oswald, Mark at MDB 1958, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matt Saroyce, Max Romero, Michael Bailey, Michael Kramer, Mike Jameson and This Lightsaber Kills Fascists and Pop Culture Basement, Mike Thomas, Mo Walker, Nuno Duarte, Otaku Mike, Parker Oliveira 92, Paul Kian, Pedro Angosto, Prairie Justice, the Greg Sanders Vigilante Podcast, Rick Lee James, R.J. Rosenkilt, Rob Kelly, Robert Junker, S. Matthew Stolte, Scott X, Sean Manning, Sean Ross, Silverman on Security, Siskoid, Slangword Scott, Stephen E. Shend, Stop, Let's Team Up, Superman Always, Symbol Pending, Taylor James Tonson, The Earth 2 Podcast, The Monitor Tapes Podcast, Tim Price, Outcasters, A Batman and the Outsiders Podcast, Tony D., Turn-Based Mindset, Venkman, Wilfredo Rosario, and Zek Cap Boots. Woo! My thanks to all of you for your support of the JSA and the 90s podcast. Your feedback is such a critical part of the show, folks, and this community of JSA fans we're building together is fantastic. And seriously, I appreciate every single one of you, and I hope all of you have a very happy holiday season and a wonderful start to 2026. Now, if I've forgotten or missed anyone, I am terribly sorry. It is probably the fault of Tim Price or Siskoid. I do my best to find all the social media comments, but sometimes they do slip through my internet fingers. So please keep those cards and letters coming, folks. The best way is at our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com. facebook.com/JSA. Leave your comments on the show post there, and fellow JSA fans can share their thoughts and you can communicate together, and you'll get read on these episodes. Now, you can also find us on social media platforms as JSA Presents, including Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, Twitter or X, and Threads, or you can email us at justicesocietypresents@gmail.com. But again, the best place is leave your feedback on our website. That's the best way to ensure that it gets read on the show. And my thanks again to you listeners for such a great collection of feedback. Now, we're going to take a quick podcast promo break. When we come back, we'll connect with this episode's guest, Jose Rivera and Steve Gibbons, and we'll spike some eggnog together. Okay, folks, we're back from break, and yes, we've got both Jose and Steve back with us to roast chestnuts and eat candy canes. Now, first, Jose, thank you so much for appearing on this episode. Again, I have known for a long time that when I covered the Starman issue, I wanted you on board, and I couldn't have been happier. Thank you so much, buddy. Why don't you tell the listeners where they can find more of you, buddy?
I'm kind of on social media, but you can really find me on further replays of this episode.
Just keep playing it on a loop, folks. Again, Jose, thank you so much for doing this, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Now, Steve, thank you so much for appearing on this episode. It was absolute blast talking about Flash with you. I knew you were the guy I wanted to talk about a Wally West Flash issue. I've known for over a year you were the guy to do this episode. I just forgot to invite you until like a month ago. Whoops.
Hey, it's fine. I'm always up to talk about the Flash, and I think I have the Fire and Water Network under contractual obligation to bring me on whenever you guys do talk about the Flash, because the Franklins have had me on like two or three times to talk about the Flash on the JLU podcast. So yeah, I'm always happy to talk about my favorite character.
Well, it's always a joy to talk with you, period, sir. So why don't you tell the listeners where they can find more of you out in the world?
Well, having been sucked into the world of podcasting by the diabolical people at the Fire and Water Network, I've actually started two podcasts of my own. One of them is comic book related, JLA Stories and Friends, and I was happy to be part of the JS April crossover last year.
Woohoo!
And it's just a podcast where I try to match up good JLA related stories with friends of mine, and I'm going to have a new slate of episodes coming out in the new year. The other podcast is very niche, so it's not going to be for everybody, but it's I'm involved with a community theater in my area called the Possum Point Players. I'm in southern Delaware. I'm on the Delmarva Peninsula specifically, so we're in southern Delmarva. The podcast is called Let's Talk Possum, and I just bring people on. Yeah, I bring people on who are involved in our various shows. We talk about the productions, help promote the shows, and if you are a listener and you're in the Delaware area in the next coming year, come see Possum Point Players. Come to our theater. We got a lot of great shows going on this season coming up. So yeah, I'm also out and about on various social media and whatnot. So hey, if you see me, say hello to me and try not to hold it against me that I'm friends with Shag.
Oh man, I knew there was going to be a dig in there somewhere. It was like a ticking bomb.
Yeah, well, you know.
Well, again, Steve, I really appreciate it. This has been a joy celebrating the holidays with you.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't know I was celebrating the holidays with you. Am I invited to your house? Are we going to have like a turkey dinner and whatnot?
If you're the turkey. All right. All right, folks. Well, that is going to do it. Now, come back next episode when we begin our coverage of the 8-issue miniseries called Justice Society of America from 1991, which is technically the first comic book series ever to be called Justice Society of America. So it's very exciting. And I'll be joined by a fantastic guest to help me cover the issue. Who will it be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Jose.
And I'm Steve.
And we're asking you to join the fight
for justice
and candy canes.